Baby dope. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Say Report. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and you've just caught me in the middle of karaokeing. I'm joined today by my always outrageous host companion, Sejan Sarawick. Sejan, why don't we give him a show?
This is like you invited everybody over to your house for a party. We all showed up, and you answered the door in like a robe, like, "Oh, I wasn't expecting you." Like, what the fuck?
Yes, so
You
Sejan has been to a
started this
party at my
nonsense.
house. You didn't need, inside baseball, that's exactly what happens. I expect you to bring the food, the booze. I'm just going to be there in a robe. Oh, the fun. Ouch. I'm wounded. You've wounded me. Oh, Sejan, I'm in a good mood. You know why I'm in a good mood? Couple of
Because you
reasons.
clearly watched Sergeant Bilko this week and you won't stop sending me gifts from
I
it.
think I sent you one screenshot from Sergeant Bilko.
I'm looking at a second GIF as
Oh
well.
no.
Oh, wait, you know what? I think I might have sent that to
I
you
think you sent
because
it
in
in response
response.
to me. Yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I guess I am the originator, the progenitor of the Sergeant Bilko gif off that didn't really go anywhere. Oh man, I watched Sergeant Bilko this week too. I had a great week. But no, one of the reasons I'm excited is right now we're recording this episode and it gets released in No Man's Land. And I know that for most people it's already Christmas, but for me, that very odd time when Thanksgiving happens and then you have almost a full week before it's December, I love that. I absolutely love that in November. And I totally feel like I'm just in no man's land right now. I could, and I have, embrace a little bit of the Christmas celebration, but I'm still kind of allowed to be a bit of a cynical dick regarding the fact that, like, well, it's still not technically a Christmas time.
Well, I think what you're talking about is something relatively recent in it's kind of the anti-Christmas creep that people have tried to really develop, I think, over the last few years, especially as we kind of were all sitting on our hands at home and people were getting way too happy about the possibility of Christmas without thinking about what Christmas was actually going to mean second 2020 and 2021, but the big thing is that I realized that that Christmas creep that everybody talks about, right? Like that thing that you're trying to combat, that you're saying you're in this weird space of not feeling. We've talked about that as if this is like something new, right? Like people talk about like Christmas, it always seems to get earlier and earlier and earlier. And it only really occurred to me this year as I was like forced to watch the Macy's Day Parade beginning to end, which has never really happened in my
My
life. Like it's always
God.
just been a thing on in the background. But I was with a group of people this year where like, no, this is what we do. We sit down and we put the parade on and we pay attention. I was
My
like,
deepest condolences to you
okay.
because they've started the Macy's Day Parade earlier and earlier.
Yeah. And then I'm out here in Utah, so we're already, anyway, the end of Macy's Day Parade always has been Santa.
Yeah, Santa comes out.
So it's this idea that like it happens that I was like, man, we talk about like Christmas getting earlier as if like this is like a new phenomenon, but they've been trying to push Christmas on us earlier and earlier for literally
Ever since at
decades,
least
right?
1935, right? When
Yeah,
A
yeah.
Miracle on
So
31st Street.
And like you want to talk about how Christmas has gone even further, earlier
34th Street,
than
sorry.
Thanksgiving. Like, yeah, like definitely. But there's just this idea that the Christmas coming as early as Thanksgiving being Christmas one, that's not a new idea.
It's sort of like the dress rehearsal, or really, for all you theater geeks out there in the audience, which I have to imagine it's almost exclusively theater geeks out there in the audience. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming to our weekly shows. We appreciate you. It's sort of the tech
We're
dress.
sorry.
It's like the tech dress
Yeah.
for
Invited dress,
Christmas.
right? Yeah, yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Because
There's a certain level of it that also for a lot of families it has become the we, this year we'll do Thanksgiving with this family and Christmas with that one. And that also invites a lot of that, right? Because like if you're going to one side of the country to see grandma and grandpa number one, right, and they're not gonna see you for Christmas, what are they gonna do? They're gonna treat it like it's Christmas, right? And then it's become kind of like the pseudo Christmas out of necessity for a lot of families.
and yet I'm here. I'm just raging against the cage. I'm grabbing the bars. I'm shaking it because I want Thanksgiving to still mean Thanksgiving to me. And I'm able to do it. I'm able to make that work. But I do know that every year, as I get a little bit older and my groups grow a little bit more, that one day that might not be the case. So, but I do. I really like this moment that we're in right now, where it is officially like there's the Christmas taint, right? There's that week between Christmas and New Year where it's like it just kind of feels like, oh, what are we doing? Some people call it Kwanzaa, and it's
ouch.
No, I don't know. Kwanzaa is a weird thing that maybe we'll deep dive into someday because we're a show about everything. But, like, you want to talk manufactured holidays and the guy behind it and what he was aiming for. It's not the noblest thing. But it is those 7 days between Christmas and New Year's. And, right. You know, that's essentially what it's celebrating. So this kind of feels like that weird sort of Thanksgiving taint to me, where I'm totally fine watching Christmas stuff right now. I'd like to not listen to Christmas music, though there has been one specific Christmas song that has been spinning on my Spotify playlist every friggin' day. And I think once we talk a little bit more about things that I've done... There'll be more.
You're like dying over there.
I'm super excited. I've been very dry. I've had 4 glasses of milk this morning, which you know that makes a person phlegmy, and that's not smart to do. But I went to there's one.
Kevin's trying to ignore Christmas. Meanwhile, he's sitting around eating Christmas cookies and milk all morning.
I have not eaten a single Christmas cookie. I had 2 Doughboys, fried dough for breakfast. I did have a 6 scoop sundae on Friday. At the dairy bar, I don't even know the name of it. I should know it. I think it's the.
Are you
Crescent
just doing
Moon
like a lactose intolerant
bar?
Speed run? What are you doing over there?
Well, I was talking to somebody who was lactose intolerant, and they said, I'm trying to build up my tolerance to lactose, and I'm like, oh, what like to poison? That's not really how it works. But then. It did get dairy into my mind. And I don't know. These are all big stories that I want to share, but I need to address one thing before we get much deeper into the episode. And that is, we are turning to you, Say Report listeners. Sejin and I know of a movie. It's called Dutch. It stars... Ed O'Neill, Al Bundy from Married with Children, or... what is his name in Modern Family?
Jay Pritchett
from Modern Family. You know, we'll appeal to both generations that might be listening, all 3 generations that might. I don't know if there are any Zillennials listening, but if you are listening, thank you, Gen Z. We appreciate you too.
You really want to appeal to an inner generation. You got to talk about Dragnet that happened for all of 6 episodes.
And Dragnet's fantastic because he's with Ethan Embry again, and it's Ethan Embry and him who are in the movie Dutch, right?
Yeah. Yes.
The inner generation that appeals to is literally you and I. I don't think there aren't a lot of people who do that. But I do love the story. Ethan Embry has told it a bunch of times about that first day on Dragnet where he goes up to Al Bundy. I had his name before. Ed O'Neill. And he goes, hey, it's really great to be working with you again. And Ed O'Neill had no fucking clue who Ethan Embry was. Which is why we are asking you out there in Say Report land. It's an inspired part of the title of this episode. If you are familiar with the film Dutch... Please reach out to us and let us know. Because
to be clear, what's great about that story is because anybody that knows anything about Ed O'Neill knows that like he very famously has a very like beloved persona like on set. Like there's a lot of people, you know, I'm sure you could find somebody out there that has found some issue working with him because that's the case when you work with people, right? But overall, like Modern Family especially had a lot of stories about how he brought a lot of swinging power to like negotiations for the cast and stuff like that as like, you know, as fucking Ed O'Neill. So it's just really funny because it just seems like the movie Dutch has gone out of so many people's minds. It's even gone out of Ed O'Neill.
Well, I mean, Ed O'Neill has gone. So before we talk about the movie Dutch, because we're going to talk a little bit about the movie Dutch, not a huge one, because I'd still like to eventually cover it, perhaps in a very special episode where we like really deep dive into it. But I need to know that people still know of the movie Dutch, starring Ed O'Neill and Ethan Embry. It's a classic potential stepfather and young boy. Trying to get across the country for Thanksgiving film. A classic, as if they're making those hand over fist. I think it might be the only one in its genre. But it's a movie. CJ and I were talking about Thanksgiving movies, as we often do around this time of year. And he brought up Dutch. And I'm like, man, I friggin' love Dutch. But, like, you can't find it anymore. It's as if it's been scraped from the collective memory of humanity. And then that is a great story. Because
to
Ed O'Neill...
To be clear, like, the roadshow, not inappropriate father, what's the word I'm looking for, like the not ready dad, that story of having to do the whole road trip buddy comedy with the kids stuff. I mean, that's a thousand times over, right? Like, that's a ton. I mean, even at the end of the day, that's what the vacation films really are, is that, like, Clark Griswold is not a great dad just speaking of Ethan Embry and road movies. But the other one I think of is what's the one that Ice Cube there did? Are we there yet? Right? Like that one, or the Martin Lawrence one where he's taking his kids to college. It's the Disney one that he did, right?
College,
like,
road trip. This is, yeah, so I mean, like, great.
There is a genre of film that is very much in this. So you joke that, like, there's not many movies like it, but there's a ton of movies.
But it's one of those situations where the ones from the 90s specifically, because all the ones that you just mentioned are from the early 2000s or the late 2000s. I think College Road Trip may have been 2007. Those movies seem to have been forgotten, because, like, the other one that I always think of is Man of the House with Chevy Chase and Jonathan Taylor Thomas, which, like,
yeah,
is not
they don't really do much of a road
movie,
trip.
But it is.
Yeah, they don't really do much of a road trip in that one.
But they go on the camping trip. You could kind of, I could fudge it into there. But that movie, like, people don't remember that it exists. I bring up Man of the House and everybody's like, oh, Tommy Lee Jones with all the sorority girls? And I'm like, get the hell out of my house, right?
Oh, no, the big one around here whenever I bring that one up is everybody thinks I'm talking about Jungle to Jungle. And they're like, oh, the Tim Allen one. And I'm like, no, Chevy Chase with the driftwood. Never mind, it's fine. We don't have to talk about it.
It's Chevy Chase and friggin' George Wendt reuniting after first appearing together in Fletch and being such good friends. It's good times. But yeah, so if you're out there in Say Report land, please get to us on Twitter at the Say Report, or call us. If you have my number, if you have Siege's number, pause the podcast right now, give us a call, and let us know that you remember the movie Dutch. Hockey is another thing that we're saying. It's kind of, and maybe this is the reason why it's been forgotten, it is sort of this huge conflagration of everything that was popular in cinema at the time. Precocious young actor, hockey, and unprepared father all coming together into this weird amalgam film.
Right, right. Yeah. And in true early 90s fashion, becomes a moderately mediocre film. Like that's the other big thing about Dutch. Like, as much as you and I can gush about it all we want, at the end of the day, the reason it is not, like, fondly beloved or remembered is because it's not a bad movie in any way, which would honestly garner its own kind of support, right? It's just also not, like, a mind-blowingly stellar film in any fashion.
At the end of the day, it's not Home Alone. And Home Alone is this gold standard at the time for holiday entertainment featuring
holiday
a precocious young child. So,
what
it is. But let us know if you remember Dutch. Because we want to know if you remember Dutch or if we're just tilting at windmills on this particular topic.
Dirty Grandpa also falls into this category, and any time I can mention Dirty Grandpa, I will burn out.
With Zac Efron, or do you mean Bad Grandpa?
No. With Jason Mantzoukas.
So good. Jason Mantzoukas being the main draw of that, playing Pam. I love Dirty Grandpa. That was one of my favorite movies that year, and I saw it, like, at the very beginning of the year.
I didn't see it when it first came out, and that's the, you know, like, I love Zac Efron, and you know, Robert De Niro's comedy films have always actually kind of brought me joy. Like, someday we will have to sit down and talk about, like,
good. Sorry.
There are two different De Niros in the world, right? If anybody had told me that that was actually a triple header film with Jason Mantzoukas as the third, I would have been in seats day one. I had no idea. I, like, offhandedly heard him make a joke about it once and was like, wait, he's in Dirty Grandpa? And then assumed it was just, like, a scene. Watched that movie and, like, no, he's, like, the third lead of that film.
I'm also not going to slough off the fact that Aubrey Plaza is in that film, just killing it. And it's the year of Zoe Deutsch, Howard Deutsch and Leah Thompson's daughter, because she does Dirty Grandpa, she does, what the fuck is it, Everybody Wants Some, and then she does Why Him? She has this whole year of films. She basically tries to do a Jim Carrey 1994. And two of those movies are my favorite movies from the year. Why Him is not that great is what I have to unfortunately say. There ain't no mystery here. I don't want anyone thinking that one of my favorite movies of the year 2015 was Why Him, because unfortunately it's not. But Dirty Grandpa and fucking Everybody Wants Some, that's a wonderful Zoe Deutsch doubleheader. If you're looking,
yeah, and the
for
eventual terrifying toys esque sequel War with Grandpa was also quite fascinating to watch.
I thought that was a prequel. Who knows? But we're having a good time talking about movies in No Man's Land, right? Dutch in No Man's Land. There, I dropped the title for you. But yeah, so I'm just in this like really good mood. And that's where I've been at, and I have more to share. But Sijin, tell us where you've been. Tell us where you're approaching this episode from.
Well, I'm still just trying to play catch up with some brain power, man. I joked about how we watched the Macy's Day Parade on Thursday, but the truth is like the reason that we sat down and watched the parade is not just because the people we were hanging out with were like, we need to do this, but the reason we were even there to begin with is like we somehow got roped into doing two different Thanksgivings this year, and not just like showing up, but like throwing them. So like I've cooked two turkeys, I did two mashed potato dishes this year, we did four pies, like we made so much food and we had to do so much work. And then like the worst part was beginning of the week, we planned this out. We had like marching orders, we had a war table set up, we had a map up on the wall with pins on it and strings connecting it about where we were going to be when, like we had all of this shit prepared. And then Monday night I'm like, my throat's a little itchy. I'm a little sniffly. Man, I should take some allergy medicine or something. Get some sleep. Get a little bit of sleep. Woke up Tuesday just on my ass. Just, like, could not get out of bed. So lost an entire day of, like, prep and all of that this week with having to do two Thanksgivings. Wednesday was just, like, a nightmare scenario. Like, we did so much cooking and so much. And then we had to get up at 5 a.m. on Thursday to drive out to where we were going to cook one turkey and then get home that night and then prepare for the next day. So, like, it's just been a madhouse of Thanksgiving, just like smells and sounds and the dogs freaking out because there's too much good food that they can't have, and me freaking out because there's too much good food I can't have, and like it's been a crazy, crazy week. So much so that like avid listeners will note that last Monday we actually had to drop an old banked episode of ours focusing on Thor. Hope you all enjoyed that. That was a good time, man. That episode was, I mean, you were making fun of me because you didn't think I'd listen to it, but like I've listened to that episode. Don't worry.
I'm sure you have. It was just fun. Also, congratulations to you, right? Because I mean, let's be honest. I also was like, it'd be really nice to just take a break and use Thanksgiving week as a break, as a time off. I kind of coded it like I'm doing you a favor, Sijin, while being like, I'm doing myself a favor too. I went to China Buffet for the first time in like, at least 3 years, I guess, if we're going to be completely honest about it. Because I had some friends from Indiana, and I got to spend the whole Sunday with him without like the fear of like, well, I got to get back to record the show, and so that was really nice. I really did enjoy it, but 19 weeks, man, without us having to drop that episode, that's a new record from us recording a time capsule and then using the time capsule. And also, of our time capsule episodes, that Thor episode, which if you didn't pick it up from the title, Thuv and Lunder, that's what that episode is about. Sorry, I thought it was hilarious. It's my fault that we just gave it that weird thing. The expiration date was kind of up on the particular seal on that one as soon as Wakanda Forever dropped,
yeah,
in a weird way.
No, no truer than this very weekend when I was sitting around with a bunch of people talking about Marvel movies, because inevitably, right? Like,
yeah,
we don't really talk politics in this family, but we'll talk nerd stuff. And so that the conversation just like fell flat the second that I mentioned Thor. Like, everybody wanted to talk about Black Panther, and it was just like, yeah, no, fair enough. So, although I was the only one there that had so far seen Werewolf by Night, because a lot of people, when I bring this up, seem to have this very weird reaction of like, oh right, that came out, like nobody has seen it but everybody kind of remembers that it exists. And I fear that that's going to be kind of the nature of that thing for the rest of its life.
Well, while we're doing this and while we're sharing fears, have you done the Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special yet?
No, we're doing it tonight.
Okay,
We have special
excellent.
plans to do it tonight. No, I finally, it's part of the reason we didn't was that I'm actually still doing Halloween watching. I finally convinced the family last night to sit down and watch Wendell and Wild on Netflix because
Nice.
I've been dying to like show it to everybody. So we're still doing Halloween movies, but I told them last night after we did Wendell and Wild that that was the last like scary movie I was going to push on them. I'm putting quotes around scary, but like it is definitely Halloween.
The last Halloween feature is finished.
Yeah,
That's good.
but
No.
so we're gonna start doing some holiday stuff. We did do the Even Stevens Hanukkah special right after Wendell and Wild last night, just to kind of like work our way into some of the holiday watching. Man, that Hanukkah special is something else, huh?
Yeah, I don't really remember anything about Even Stevens except for the one
That's
where Shia LaBeouf's character, something Stevens, is
Lewis,
Lewis,
yeah.
Lewis, Lewis Stevens, where everybody's doing a walk, like the walk type marathon where you get paid for every mile that you cover. And he's like, I'm gonna just lay in a bed. And I'm just like, this is weird because that whole episode, like, none of it makes any sense to me. Because it's like, you're gonna get paid for however many hours you sleep. But then he's like jumping on the bed and everybody's still all happy watching him. Like, the logic of that particular episode of Even Stevens broke the show Even Stevens for me, where
Oh
I'm
no,
just
that show
like,
is broken from the get-go because can I
huh.
tell you what the logic is of the Hanukkah special is? It's all about how he finds the Hanukkah presents in the house and then destroys them by accident. And his family's very mad at him and he gets grounded for Hanukkah and he wishes wonderful lifestyle that he was never born and he is shown a world in which he's not born. And in that world in which he's not born, his family's lives are so much better, right? Except that they have no like joy. There's like this like weird like pseudo Lewis character that now exists because he wasn't born, another one was instead, and that one is a bit of a jerk. But like that's the worst of it for them, is that there
I'm
he's
sorry, I
just
have
like
to
he's
time out there. Lewis isn't a bit of a jerk.
well, so but the difference being that this one's a bit of a jerk and only cares about like school. He's a bit of a jerk, but cares about making people laugh. And that seems to be the only resolution of that episode, is that because his family doesn't have him, they don't have fun doing anything that they do. And so when I say that that show is broken all around, that show for specifically for the Lewis Stevenson character, for the Shia LaBeouf character in that show, the entire concept is like he's an attention-seeking jerk, as Devin has pointed out, and the world revolves around making that okay for him to be. Like that show and the lessons in which it tries to teach, it doesn't try to teach lessons, I think is the real secret, is it's not trying to be that kind of show, but the ways in which that kind of informed a generation of young boys, young white boys, that like being the obnoxious class clown prick was going to be okay, was an okay path to choose. It's crazy. Like the shit he gets away with because people just write it off as there always has to be at least one, boys will be boys, is essentially the entire attitude of that character. And it's just like, oh my God, it's just like, what is going on? Why are we allowing this? Because in the Hanukkah special, right, he destroys all these toys, just wishes that he wasn't alive because it's just because his family's mad at him, not because he's like upset about what he did or anything like that. He doesn't want to be grounded for Hanukkah. And then what he learns is he should be this ridiculous with them all the time, and it's okay that he got in trouble this time because maybe next time it won't be him getting in trouble. Like the resolution is him like putting a raw chicken on his head and running around the house and destroying the Hanukkah dinner for this family, and they love it. They think it's great because like I said, up till then they've had this like jerk Lewis character that has been like good at math. Apparently, the opposite of that is destroying Hanukkah.
Hanukkah isn't that important. Plus, you only ruined one day of it, son.
Essentially,
Yeah.
like credits roll. Yeah,
No,
it's
it's.
that show was nuts. I forgot there was a third sibling on that show.
That's the older brother, Donnie. Donnie
Yeah, Donnie, and
Stevens.
then eventually we get
They
a
have a
fourth. We
younger
get the
brother or
yeah. The, well,
sister.
I don't know if Beans is a brother or a
Oh,
cousin because
Beans is a next door neighbor.
I
Beans is
Beans
not
is the
there.
next door neighbor,
But then
right?
they do have a younger sibling too.
Oh,
Like
geez,
that's
yeah.
like a baby. Yeah, Beans is just their next door neighbor, and it's like, oh man, Lewis Stevens, we kind of want to do more like serious stories, so we have to shift all the annoyance off of him onto Beans.
Yeah.
Whatever. It's
Give me flash forward any day of the
oh, I
week.
love flash forward. I don't know. It's just one of those things I don't ever really think about Even Stevens, but that episode where I'm just like, this is broken. Like, I don't get, this isn't fun for me to watch. And then, by all accounts, some of the stuff that Christy Carlson Romano has come out and said about working on that show. It sounds
still fantastic on that show, though. That's the one highlight of watching that episode, is watching Christy Carlson Romano and remembering, like, oh man, like, and she goes on to do like Broadway and stuff after that, right? She's the originator of Belle and stuff, if I'm remembering correctly.
So she at least played Belle once. I don't know if she was the first person to play it on Broadway, but she did play it at some point. Thoughts and things that are in my mind when you bring up Even Stevens, and just
so,
like,
it's been a lot of that sort of stuff, right? Like holiday watching stuff going through, and but also filling kind of the time with just some other big drops this week. Disney dropped their Mickey Story of a Mouse documentary. And I mean, it's a documentary about Mickey Mouse. What I will say here's, so it's not like there's nothing more I can really tell you if you've either decided at that point whether you're going to watch it or not, right?
Yeah.
The one thing I will say that really surprised me about it is how much it is an exploration of actual animation. It's not just like, here's Mickey in the world and here's why you should love him. There's a lot of that in there too. I mean, it is very, there's a lot of moments that feel very propaganda-y. There are moments where they bulldoze over pieces of the history or like twist something in the history to be like, and Walt Disney, the greatest man that ever lived, and you're just like, now wait a minute. we know one or two things about Walt now that make that not true. but like, so there is a lot of that, right? But the focus that they have on specific animators, animation styles, why they chose certain things about, like, here's why Mickey has gloves now, like those kinds of conversations are very cool. So like, I do encourage people to watch it. It was really, really good time. But that being said, it's very hard to watch that and not think the entire time how weird it feels, because it's Disney basically patting itself on the back the entire time, you know?
Yeah, and that's what all documentaries are. We have to wait until everyone at Disney is dead to get the real shit from them.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you say all documentary, but there's plenty of documentaries out there that are hard-hitting. This is not that, right?
Well, yeah,
like,
but it's not... I guess what I'm talking about is Straight Outta Compton is pretty hard-hitting with some of the stuff that it talks about in it, but then there is other stuff that will definitely come to light when we get... like the documentary years later, and none of the original members of NWA, I keep trying to put a different vowel at the end of that, and NWA are not there to say, you're not releasing this.
Yeah, sure. No, like, I mean, there's bias in every documentary, right? Like, acknowledging that is important whenever you're doing anything that claims that it's non-fictional. You know, you have to still figure out where the edges are, right?
Yeah.
And if it's a good documentary, it establishes those bluntly. Like, it'll openly talk about where certain lines are. And, you know, and to that point, maybe that is okay in this Mickey one, because it's pretty obvious where the lines are, right? So, like, yeah, you know, just know that going in, is that every documentary you watch is coming at whatever topic from an angle.
Any story about anything, like biopics too. I know that that's remember that that's technically fiction. Reminded
that Whitney Houston one that's coming out, is so
wild.
Like, I'm very curious to see where that one goes with what we know about that story in particular, and about the ripple effects of her success in that moment later on in her career and life. Like, I don't know what that movie is going to be in the end.
And that's something that we brought up at Thanksgiving dinner. I shared Sejin's fears when we saw the trailer for I Want to Dance with Somebody before Black Adam. And it's like, oh, they're doing a Whitney Houston. That's going to be so sad. And I'm like, is it though? Because it's the Bohemian Rhapsody people. And they just did a lot of backflips and omissions of the truth. The weirdest thing in Bohemian Rhapsody is that Freddie Mercury wants to go off and do a solo album, and everybody's mad at him about that. But, like, Live Aid is 1985. By 1985, Brian May had been in two other bands and released two solo albums. Like, Queen was the thing that they all kind of worked on together. Like, we agree that this is our big collaborative group. But that wasn't stopping them from going out and doing their own stuff on the side. So it is Brian May yelling at him. It's weird.
Yeah, well, it's a weird pseudo-narrative that we hear all the time in these music stories, even in like fake ones like Spinal Tap and Popstar and stuff like that, right? Where the idea of one person in the band wanting to go off on their own somehow means the immediate death of the band and all its success. And we now know and maybe part of this is just because of the ways that musicians interact with fans nowadays. Maybe this is being somewhat like I'm looking back and applying bullshit from 2022 in a way that didn't exist. Exist 40 years ago, but like that's just not it's not it doesn't matter nowadays. There are people everywhere. I mean, look at somebody like I was gonna say Charles Groban and not Josh Groban. What's his nuts from Foo Fighters?
Dave Grohl.
Dave Grohl, thank you. I'm sorry, I'm just thinking Charles Groban singing Foo Fighters
His
songs
name is
now.
Grodin. Charles Grobin is the weird mashup of Josh Grobin and Charles Grodin. I like it.
Josh Groban, I would pay so much money to watch Josh Groban in a new Beethoven movie. But no, Dave Grohl, I mean, like, who has run three or four different bands of his own and done a solo career. And then, there's other people within those bands that have gone off and done their own thing. Jack White, like, there's plenty of people who run these super successful mega bands that still tour with them. Those bands don't not exist anymore, but they do tons of stuff off on their own. So that whole idea of, like, you want to go off on your own, you're going to ruin this band is, like, such bullshit. And it
And
always has been.
it's bigger bullshit. Like, it's not, that's not new. Like, what you're talking about is
Yeah.
our exposure to it is kind of new. But you think about, like, no, but Brian May had done two solo albums before Freddie Mercury's like, I kind of want to just do my own thing. I want to explore myself. Oh, fuck you, Freddie Mercury. How dare you? It's a little hypocritical, Brian May. But I guess the person who wrote this either didn't know about that or decided I'm going to ignore it because who knows about that? Turns out
It's
a
got to
lot of
start with the
people.
Yoko and Lennon, right? Like,
Yeah.
that's got to be where this hatred starts for people that quote unquote break up the band. Like, John Lennon deciding that he doesn't want to do the Beatles anymore after they've had like half a decade of immense success. They have what, half a dozen albums like in 5 years? It's crazy how much music the Beatles produce in such a short amount of time. I think it's actually only 4 years, but there's like such a small window in which the Beatles were the Beatles, and it's all we remember them for now. And people are convinced to this day that the reason that we don't get more Beatles music, I mean, certain people you talk to, they're convinced the reason John Lennon's even dead is because he leaves the Beatles to have a career, and they blame that on Yoko Ono. But like you're saying, no, that's just what people did. It's like you spent 5 or 6 years with a band producing a certain type of music. You wanted to do something that was not in line with what the rest of the group wanted to do. You didn't just give up on that. You just went and did it. And if you succeeded as a solo artist, then you became awesome as a solo artist.
And there's no bigger like evidence of that fact than the fact that George Harrison, Paul McCartney, even Ringo Starr, and John Lennon went off and did solo things after the Beatles.
Quite
It's
successfully.
just not like it's not like Kiss, where two members of Kiss leave and then the remaining two members are like, "But I want to keep this going. I want to keep doing Kiss." It's not like, "Well, we lost John. I guess we'll have to find another singer." Like, no, that's not what they did. They're like, yeah, I guess the sort of Beatles era of our life is over. And the Beatles era of their life was over when they're like, we're not touring anymore. We're just gonna sit in a studio and record music because touring is exhausting. All we're
Well,
doing
especially at
is.
the they were, right?
Yeah,
Like,
exactly.
they were international stars, and they were international. Just like they were everywhere for just a couple of years. They finally got home and thought, okay, don't want to do that again. And they had every right to say
Yeah,
that.
we're lucky we got more music with them at all after they're like, we're not gonna tour anymore. Do you still guys want to just still do music together? Yeah, I guess. Like, it could have very easily been, no, why don't we, like, this was fun, this was an exciting experience, but why don't we go work on our own stuff? Maybe we collaborate a couple years down the line. Like, it's such a weird thing. But also, you need to think about what fiction is, and fiction, the center of any fiction is conflict. And, by disguising what would be a breakup in any other genre of film, in the fact that, like, someone wants to leave this band or wants to do their own thing, and how is that going to affect the other members of the band? Like, it's a beautiful little pit of conflict that you can dig into. You can just take a little slice off at the beginning to, like, sow those seeds, or you can, like, lop off a whole frickin' chunk to be your break into three. It's a wonderful bit of conflict, but it's an unfortunate bit of conflict because it has affected how we look at bands so often.
artists in general, right? Because then with the Whitney stuff, like going back to that, part of the reason that I'm so they're building up this whole idea of her like breaking off and doing this whole solo thing and proving that she can, you know, she can be this powerhouse, is which is true of that moment in her career and that song and all that. But it's also like it's when she really loses a lot of lifelines that became really important to her later, or would have been really important to her later. And like, I don't know if they're going to address any of that. Like in that whole like creating a good fiction for the movie, like what do they lose and what do they keep is always, you know, always part of the conversation with these kinds of films. And we haven't seen Wanna Dance with Somebody yet. So like who knows? Maybe it's a phenomenally well-crafted piece that captures all of that. I just fear that a lot like what you're talking about with Bohemian Rhapsody is like you lose a lot and a lot of stuff gets muddied and grayed and a lot of things get misconstrued in a way that like works great for a Oscar-worthy experience in the cinema, but when you're talking about it in terms of music history and specifically history of this artist, like there's a lot of really important questionable shit that happened in Whitney's life that like we ain't gonna talk about. And it's just really wild because at the end of the day, also like it also just feels very exploitative. And it did with Freddie Mercury too, but here with this one, it feels weirder because I think we're so much closer to the events of losing Whitney Houston, and the events of losing Whitney Houston were just kind of horrific in the end. Like it's just there's so much about it that also just feels very like gazy. I don't love that either.
Yeah, it's you're right. Freddie Mercury passed away in the early 90s, and then the movie comes out in the early 2010s. So it doesn't feel as exploitive as somebody who passed away, like I want to say less than like 8 years ago, right? Like
Yeah,
it's
10 years ago
a
or something to that effect. Yeah.
it's some
At least it
ridiculous.
feels like that. Yeah, it's
It
weird.
feels strange. And then also when you look at things like Bohemian Rhapsody, we have Bohemian Rhapsody because the way that you were able to watch Black Adam, the way that you like stopped your brain from buzzing after that trailer as like, what is going to happen? Oh my freaking God. What is you're like, but it's just going to be about the song, right? They're just going to focus on the song and everything will be okay. We're not going to get into the deeper, scarier parts of what happens to Whitney Houston. It'll just be about, I want to dance with somebody. And then I'm also thinking in my mind though, and I'm like, that's good. I'm glad that Sejan has soothed himself. But let's talk about in Bohemian Rhapsody, where Freddie Mercury, they made it look like he was on his deathbed because of AIDS prior to the Live Aid performance, when like he wasn't diagnosed with AIDS until like 3 years later and didn't like talk about it or have anything that until like 1991, like right when it was about to like end him. So it was really strange that they're like, well, everyone knows that Freddie Mercury died of AIDS. We can move up the timeline on that a little bit. And it's like, well, that's also real exploitive of my emotions.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm excited to see
Well, it's weird because
it.
it turns Freddie Mercury into the AIDS artist.
Yeah.
As opposed to the guy that created Bohemian Rhapsody, it now becomes a story about an artist struggling with this horrific disease, which is also an important story to tell, but like, don't combine the two. Like, don't, because then you end up overshadowing one with the other. And guess which one people are going to really kind of lean towards? It's going to be the one that's not about a gay guy dying of AIDS, unfortunately. That's going to be the one people really want to hear.
And if you didn't do that and you saved it, there's your sequel, Don't Stop Me Now, and you actually get to explore that and tell a really powerful story about a disease that was like a plague in this country and was like huge and had such effect on people. But to like tack it on as the third act sort of challenges that he's going through was such a weird thing. Which is why, like, are they just gonna tack on her depression in the end and then she's not gonna be depressed and sing the song and then like, don't look up anything about Whitney Houston. Don't go home and Google her.
Yeah,
Everything
right.
is fine after that. 'Cause that's how Bohemian Rhapsody felt. It's like, yeah, he overcame that. He like he had a cold and he sang that day. And don't look up Freddie Mercury.
Don't ask any more questions.
Yeah, like it.
Yeah, I mean, so to go all the way back to the Mickey documentary, right? Like, it's a lot of this sort of stuff as you're watching this movie about some of these guys that they're talking about, right? Like, they offhandedly mention Roy Disney like once, like, and about how he started the animation house with Walt, but then you never hear what happened to Roy because you don't hear about how there was a lot of weird shit between them business wise, and like that Walt kept making Roy risk his entire like life on his pet projects, and like luckily it paid off. But like, there's a million people in this country that doesn't happen, right? But they don't want to talk about that. They don't want to focus on like how crazy that was, or like the ways in which Walt didn't create Mickey himself. It was created by one of his animators or animation team, and Walt, was head of that team and definitely in the room while the character was being created. But they purposely they openly point out the story that Walt tells, which is this crazy ass story about how he was about to lose everything. And he's on a train going across the country, thinking about how he's about to lose everything, and he realizes he needs to do something to save his whole career, and like a light bulb thinks about the idea of Mickey and creates Mickey Mouse, right? But then they then say, now they had already been working on a character Mortimer Mouse. It's like, no, wait a minute. But then they use the phrase, but that doesn't really matter, does it? It's just like, whoa, wait a minute.
Any talk of Mickey's sister in the documentary? Because I'm a big fan of Mickey's sister. I can't think of her name right now, but I love the mother of Morty and Ferdy, his nephews. And like, I've read comic books that feature her where she's just like this great, strong female character.
So they do this thing where they talk a lot about Mickey specifically and about the ways that Mickey was when he first was created. He was this very kind of precocious, mischievous, but always trying to do the right thing type character, right? Like, it's just that sometimes he tries to do the right thing in the wrong way, or sometimes he's doing the wrong thing but for the right reasons, but he's always doing that. But then as he starts to get kind of sillier and kids get more and more into him, they realize they want to like purify him, so they start breaking pieces of his personality off, and that's where you get things like Goofy and Donald. And then to that point, Minnie has to be like this foil for him, and like there's all of that sort of stuff going on. So they don't, but it could just be because they don't really talk about that part of the character, you know?
I mean, Felicity Field Mouse, I just Googled her name. She is one of those characters who's there and then she just disappears. And it'd be one of those situations where I always kind of hope that she'll come back. Sort of like how the 2017 DuckTales show brought back Della Duck into the Duck family. Because, like, everybody knew Della Duck existed if they read the Carl Barker comic books. But then, like, there was a whole 20 years there where we're not
Where
going
she
to
just
talk
wasn't
about
mentioned,
her. The boys just were immaculately conceived from three eggs that Donald found. And that's
No,
always,
the like some of the crazier stuff they talk about are things like how Fantasia it was an utter failure at the time, which was I think I knew that it had always been one of those ones that didn't do as well when it first came out, but I didn't realize how much it was like, no, it was like an artistic like triumph for Walt, and then when it failed, it literally made him go back to the drawing board for 2 years about like what he was doing with his life, like that kind of stuff. And it was like, oh wow, cool, like didn't know that, like that's good, that's cool new information, and really gives you a perspective on what was going on, why certain choices then get made in terms of where they go next in the 50s and stuff, and where they end up going with the theme park and stuff because of the just abject failure of Walt Disney trying to do something that actually meant something to him, as opposed to push the boundaries of animation for everybody else in the world, finally wanted to do something for himself, and then it falls on its ass, so that he just feels like, fine, fuck y'all.
I mean, my favorite explanation from that is that that's why Dumbo is 64 minutes long. It's like, oh, we can't do what we did with Fantasia. 64 minutes. Let's just release it and put it out the door. Because
Yeah, so
Dumbo
a lot
feels
of that sort of stuff, yeah.
like there's a lot of connective tissue that would make Dumbo a more cohesive film. And I'm not talking about the like 2019 Dumbo where they fill in some of the gaps. I mean, like in 64, some stuff just sort of happens. Like,
No, I mean it is the epitome of watching a movie and thinking, it's for kids. It's like, well, like so it's allowed to just not do like certain things that like normal storytelling would do then? That doesn't make sense.
It's really the fact that we don't see Dumbo fly until the very end of it. Like, oh, he flew off stage while he was drunk. just trust us on this one.
Oh man. Yeah, it's, you know, the other big thing is that, and they don't focus on this, but it's hard to not see it, is you think about the presence that Disney has in like the legal field now in animation and copyright and all of that sort of stuff. And you can see early on how Walt and his crew are kind of abusing those loopholes that existed then, that then make them very quick to shore them up themselves when they're in the position of power, right? The reason that they get so caught up and run the legal wheelhouse that they do, like the huge amount of power that they wield in the world in regards to that sort of stuff, exists solely because when it didn't, they were the ones exploiting it. So they walked in the door and then they slammed it shut and locked it. It's like is essentially what they what the animators in old Disney were doing every step of the way. Like and again, the movie itself isn't talking about that, but like you see it every moment. Every time they make a move to do this and then they make sure that their character is protected in this way, it's because they had just taken advantage of somebody.
Remember, kids, to shore up and cement over all the loopholes you used to get into the building. That's the Disney way.
You know, it is a fascinating film. Like it really, really is. I found it really hard to watch it and not think the whole time how much they were really prettying up a lot of this story for what was going on. You know, still cried when they show those shots of like kids running into the park and seeing Mickey for the first time, and you know, still like watching the old hand-drawn animation stuff come to life is beautiful and gorgeous. But there's a lot of gross stuff around the early years of Disney and now Disney that we as consumers just can't ignore anymore, right? And it's really interesting to watch how companies like Disney are still trying to stay relevant in like not just our minds but our hearts at a time when we know too much about some of the bad shit they've done.
And it's all been piling up. Like, just because they did bad shit, like, oh, they did bad shit in the 30s, is like, but that's not the last time that Disney did bad shit.
No.
Like,
I mean,
it'd be
like let's
one
talk
thing.
about yeah. Well, I mean, you know, so one of the conversations about Black Panther and stuff this weekend was some floating attitudes, not even really within the group, just in the world of just some stuff in which the MCU has become extremely outwardly focused from white people. Let's this seems like the most politically nice way to like talk about this. But like, you know, the ways in which the MCU is trying to like really push its boundaries on inclusiveness because it has not been great at that in the past, right? And there is starting to be this like huge push in the other direction by certain groups of people that feel like it's getting to be, what's the word here? Like fan service-y, I think was the one that was really thrown around a lot in that sort of regard. I don't know. Like it's and there's a lot of female characters now. There's a lot of characters of color on display. There's all of this sort of stuff going on, and I don't like. I hadn't. I'm trying to say this in a way that does not like sound like me patting myself on the back. It's just not a conversation I had had with anybody yet. Let's put it that way, right? Like it's just not something we that I had really heard about or anything until talking about this sort of stuff. But it goes to what kind of what we're talking about with the Disney stuff is it shows that like anybody that believes that, anybody that believes that the MCU is really progressive and that Disney is really pushing a lot of quote unquote leftist politics and all of this shit, like hasn't been paying attention because that is so recent. If it exists at all, a lot of this stuff exists is because it feels like they're trying to make up for a lot of things that they should have been doing all along. Like Black Widow did not get a movie because some progressive asshole got in there and was like, "We need to give the woman a film." It was a movie that should have came 10 years ago, dumbasses. It was a movie we should have had, and for some reason, head scratch, we didn't get this one particular Avengers solo film. I wonder what that could have been as I line them all up and look at the original lineup. Like there is something about the idea that like this isn't like paying service to what fans want. It is also that. It is also making up for the fact that this was something that we should have had already. And like it's weird to put it like that because it sounds like, oh, we were owed this, but it's more to the fact that like the character was owed that, right?
I think one of the craziest things about everything that you're talking about, those people who are saying it's so female focused now, and now every Avenger has a female counterpart. I'm like, well, I guess die staff is just like not in the vocabulary anymore. Is when they show the picture of all the quote female versions of the Avengers, Yelena, and it's just like, it's really weird that you guys are like not talking about how Black Widow was always female is weird and that, like, that's part of your citation.
I will say that to your point about the idea of the die staff counterpart, usually that refers to a world in which the male counterpart then doesn't exist, I think.
I mean, I think die staff just by vocab standards is a female counterpart of something.
That usually implied, it's usually when, like, oh, they cast this character as female instead of male, not so much like they've created a secondary character of this that is just female. Whether or not that's what the word means, that's usually where I hear it applied. So I don't know if it's got, like, specific connotations.
No, the specific connotation is, though, it feels like every superhero has a die staff counterpart now. Like, those are early criticisms from, like, comic book stuff, and that's where I learned it from, because it's not new, right? All I needed to read about was the She thing to realize that Marvel has been creating female versions of their characters since the beginning, because She thing is the craziest idea to me ever. Like, and it just looks like Ben Grimm. They didn't do anything, like, and, like, to their credit, I want to give them all the credit in the world for this. They didn't overly sexualize her. She's not like a thin rock lady. She's just like another thing character covered in rocks, and her identity is female. It's one that I respect, but it's also one of those things where, like, I don't know if we necessarily needed a She thing.
Well, I mean, it's the oldest conversation when it comes to representation of, like, do we just take a character that already exists and give it this spin, whether it's a new person, or this person's always been, you know, a woman or black or you know, there's this idea of, I mean, my favorite ghostwriter is Robbie Reyes, right? But there are a lot of people that have talked about the idea that they wish that they could have just gotten a original character for Latin American, like, youths, as opposed to, like, that, you know, there's this idea that, like, we would rather just have original characters, please, and I totally respect that conversation. It's just that there are certain times where taking an established character and giving them a different background is more powerful than just creating something new whole hog. I mean, talking about the idea of Superman, and one of the greatest, well-accepted, beloved Superman stories ever is Red Son, of just the idea of just giving him a different background, of him growing up on the other side of the world, suddenly gave everybody this new perspective on the character. And, like, you don't hear anybody talk about how, yeah, I wish they had just created a communist Superman instead of making it Clark Kent again. And it's like, no, the point is that it's Clark, but it's Clark with a different, like, upbringing, and how and it's nature versus nurture, and all of these conversations that, like, we can have that about people of otherness too, guys. Like, I don't know why, like, right? And so there has to be a balance, though, right? Because if every character just gets this treatment, then it does start to feel a little much like it starts to feel exploitive. It's one or the other, you know, it's six and one, half a dozen of the other is really what the whole conversation is.
I mean, but for She thing, I think the reason why it always felt so strange to me, and why it was like, that was my line in the sand about, like, this is not always the way to do it. I mean, first of all, I grew up reading She-Hulk comics, and for a long time, She-Hulk was kind of the foil to the Thing. And the fact that she replaced him after the Secret War, and the way that they talked and everything was buddy-buddy. And that was interesting to me, right? The way that She-Hulk works in general, the fact that she is not feared the same way that Bruce is as a Hulk, but is able to sort of rejoin society despite being a Hulk because of the nature of her mutation into an Emerald Giant is very interesting to me. But, like, one of the things about the Thing, about Ben Grimm's story, is the fact that he feels so alone in this world that, like, nobody else is understanding what he's going through. So then when you just have another person like that, like, offhandedly, it's like, and they don't have any stories about the fact that, like, oh, like, now you understand through my eyes, and, like, we can have these discussions. It's literally just to have a female version of that character. Yeah. Like, it really hit weird. And again, to their credit, the fact that she's not over-sexualized is very impressive to me. And the fact that they don't immediately start dating just because they're two rock people is really, like, they didn't completely jumped the shark for me and that concept there. But like in terms of Distaff counterpart, like, oh yeah, we need a she thing. And it's like,
yeah.
I don't know if we need a she thing, right? Is there a Mrs. Fantastic? I mean, there is. Sue Storm is married to Mr. Fantastic. But I can't think of a stretchy, like, counterpart to Mr. Fantastic who's female, right? Just like there's no Invisible Man. With Human Torch, you have Frankie Ray Nova and you have Fire Lord. There's so many Human Torches. I mean, Johnny Storm himself is just a modernization and way for Marvel to assert ownership over the character of the Human Torch because of the android one that existed in Timely Comics and them not wanting to have to be beholden to that. I do like that it showed up in the first Captain America movie, though. One of the Phineas android that looked just like the original Human Torch. Sorry, a lot of that stuff's been going through my mind too, because Namor is another one of those Timely Comic characters. So with him showing up in Wakanda Forever, just a lot of the thoughts have been, they were the big three of Timely, was Namor, Captain America, and the Human Torch. So and those are the comics that, like, well, these are what I want to read. I'm real interested in, like, these three characters because they were kind of the first in Marvel in a weird way. Sorry.
Yeah, No, I mean, Namor's a great example, though, of a character with its own history and its own baggage and a lot of other things. Like a really interesting character to explore that is in that column that ticks all those boxes of being, like, original and deep and worth exploring. There's a lot going on right now in that, but let's not act like Disney is doing all of this because this is what they always do, right? This is something new. This is something that they are trying to do. And anybody out there that it feels like they're doing too much right now hasn't been paying attention. Like, they're never going to be able to make up for the 50 plus years of destruction that they've brought to this industry in various ways. I mean, some of it being as blunt as like legal battles about copyright, and some of it being not as obvious as, like, you know, creating pyramids of businesses and companies so that they can have their piece of every pie. You know, people want to talk about, like, monopolies, and everybody is happy to talk about Disney being one of the biggest ones, but nobody really gets into the actual, like, tree or web of systems that they have created that like
that
it's not just
them?
That they are it's not just that they are a monopoly, it's that they are the monopoly, and they are, like, almost an unbreakable one, because again, they're the ones that help create the laws when it comes to this sort of stuff. When they're the ones that are creating this, they can make sure that they're carving things out in just the right way that they fit into the slot and nobody else can. Like, it's crazy how much they've had in that. So acting like this stuff that they're doing now in terms of trying to celebrate, you know, fandoms and otherness and the love of all bodies and all of this stuff is like people are like, I don't know, it's getting to be too much. And it's just like, fuck you. It'll never be enough. it'll just never be enough.
Yeah, to end this, the clickbaitiest title I saw related to Wakanda Forever, I did not click, but I was just like, wow, this is where we're at, is someone called it Marvel's Song of the South.
Whoa, okay.
And I'm just like, well, that's weird because Disney was song, and there's the same, like, I don't even want to click on whatever you're going to be trying to sell right here.
Yeah,
but like, it's,
I mean, it's nice of them to advertise that their biases right up front,
right up
like
front,
that with
right?
The headline.
Yeah.
So
ooh, it was I did
well,
not
you know,
that, but...
yeah, and to move away from some of the Disney stuff, but something that's still in the vein.
I want to talk one thing, because they dropped that doc, but they also dropped the ball. They released the Marvel Legends show. Do you ever watch that show on Disney Plus? The like clip shows of the characters. They released them out of order. So the Guardians of the Galaxy one came out on the 23rd, completely spoiled the Christmas special, the holiday special.
Oh, no.
Stuff that was in it. They've since pulled it down and put up the one that was supposed to go up, which was about Wakanda Forever. Because, you know, if you haven't seen it in the first 2 weeks, go fuck yourself. I think that's actually their new marketing scheme. But but it is. They dropped it 2 days beforehand, and huge spoilers for, like, stuff revealed in the holiday special were all over it. And so that's just,
I mean, but
so
that's
like
the,
Disney
is they
being
don't
Disney,
care about,
right? They don't,
but they
yeah.
don't care about that stuff anymore. Like, little Golden Book versions of Marvel movies come out 2 weeks before the movies now, and they tell the whole story,
Yeah.
and Pixar movies and all of that. You know, I fully expect within the next 2 or 3 months, I will have something in front of me that tells me the entire story of Elemental. Like, that's just gonna, that's, I can't even pretend to care anymore about that sort of stuff, you know?
Yeah. It was weird that they acknowledged it as a mistake. Like,
Yeah,
that was
that's
the
true.
thing about it that
That
was
is
so
definitely a
strange to
weird
me.
moment because
Because.
honestly, you'd fully expect them to just act like they meant to do it and people should just suck it up and
Right.
deal.
Especially because, like, the big spoilery thing is revealed pretty early on in the holiday special. But, like, it almost felt like the same type of marketing you'd get where we see. I mean, have you seen Wakanda Forever yet? I don't want to spoil anything for you.
Are you? Yes, we've talked about it. We straight up even mentioned it, I believe, on air at some point. But go ahead. Yeah.
We hadn't. You hadn't seen it by the in the time that I had
I
seen
saw
it.
it in the first like day it was out, so I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize. I asked if you had seen it. The way that I remember the conversation was, had you seen the movie yet? And you say, no, not yet. I'm seeing it this weekend. Whatever. It's fine. It doesn't matter. Like, but the fact that the marketing in the days leading up to it revealed the identity of the new Black Panther, that seemed weird to me. So for them to be like, this was a mistake, we're sorry, Guardians of the Galaxy fans, really just seemed out of character for Disney,
Yeah,
as
no,
we're talking
we did
about
talk about this
everything.
because I was talking
Yeah.
about how at the time that you mentioned that, I was like, well, they've also done interviews with her. Like, there was straight up just like People magazine covers about her as the new Black Panther already at that point. Like, they weren't trying to hide it within the last couple of months.
I mean, you
Like,
say
with.
that they try to have their cake and eat it too, though, because then they released the poster with her as the Black Panther, and it's just like, this was not a huge reveal. Like, you guys waited till it was out for 2 weeks to be like, oh, by the way, here's the poster we would have sent out if we weren't trying to keep it a secret. I don't know.
I didn't even catch that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because they weren't trying to
Because
keep it
they
a secret. There
weren't.
were
It was just.
toys and there were interviews and there was, I mean, the second preview they put out ended with her in the suit, like standing up in the suit. So like, I don't
Yeah.
know who they thought they were trying to keep that
I
secret
know.
from. They
It's
clearly
so.
didn't talk to anybody else. No, I think the bigger thing is, well, I mean, like,
I
I don't know.
don't
Is
know. I'm still okay.
it
I'd rather try to hold
been, yeah,
back
no,
on
let's keep
spoilers
waiting. We
for
said
it. Yeah.
we would wait until everybody had a chance to see it. So
Yeah,
we'll wait.
so.
Because there's definitely other stuff in that movie that I think are bigger spoilers that they did keep secret really
Yeah,
well.
really
And they,
well. Yeah.
right. So I mean, like, I think there's actually plenty of other stuff in that movie that they've done a very good job keeping a lid on. So, like, I do think the whole, they definitely played up. Like, I'm not going to sit here and act like they didn't play up the whole who's going to wear the mantle, like, story,
That
right?
was the
But
whole
I think,
marketing was who will it be now?
I
Yeah.
think to their credit though, it wasn't this like gross thing. Like I saw more of marketing geared towards we need to remember Chadwick Boseman, which, you know, you can have your own conversation about how you feel about the use of that in terms of marketing a film. But on the same at the same time, it was clearly a film project that was extremely important to him. So like, there's that whole thing. But I saw more towards that than I saw anything about like who's it gonna be, who's it gonna be. I had conversations about who's it gonna be with like you, but really more of it was always about like how are we going to honor Chadwick more than anything.
I guess I'm
And
talking
so
more
I don't
about
know.
the interviews with everybody, and when they would talk about it, they're like, we're not sure who's going to be Black Panther. It's like, well, you've shot the movie. I'm fairly certain y'all know
Well,
who's going to be Black
to their
Panther.
credit, apparently the movie was getting rewritten like every day. Like
Yeah.
it seems to be the case nowadays with every film, but they were talking about getting full on scene changes. So
Yeah.
and you know, they went back and reshot stuff. So God knows they could be saying that and mean it up until the day the movie comes out.
Poor Winston Duke thinking the whole time, I'm gonna be the next Black Panther. They probably let them all
Considering
think that. They all like, you're the next Black Panther. They all have suits. They all get to wear the suits. There are scenes of them in it, but there's only one canonical new Black Panther. And all the other ones are a freaking multiverse, dreams and stories to be used later on in the MCU.
So just you know, but Disney's not the only one that's trying to do this sort of stuff, right? Trying to push these boundaries, and it's not the only place that I'm hearing these kinds of stories, right? So the other big one that we had watched this week, me and my lonesome self, because I needed something to do while I was baking in the kitchen, is I tried out Netflix's School of Good and Evil, the Kerry Washington, Charlize Theron led, also Lawrence Fishburne also up there. I want to say I was pleasantly surprised by the presence of Lawrence Fishburne in this film. Yeah, so I don't really have much to say about this other than that, like, it's clearly in that same vein as like the progressive Disney stuff of like we want to try and push these old stories into new places, and that's like the whole like shtick of School of Good and Evil, and where Disney falls on its face because of it's a lot of quantity over quality, I think is the argument being made. School of Good and Evil is like, you know, this is kind of like their one shot to kind of get their foot in the door, and they're trying so hard, and it's a try hard movie. Like, that's what it feels like the whole time. Is there's a lot of stuff in it about how they're trying to be progressive, and they want you to really acknowledge how progressive they're trying to be. And you know, like, it's not like it's a weird film in that I don't have any like love or nostalgia for it. It was a book series before they made it into a movie. I thought it was supposed to be a TV show, and when you watch the movie, it feels like, man, this was really meant to be a TV show. A lot of information coming at you really fast in ways that you don't always retain it, and then you realize later it might not have even been necessary. It's just not a well made film. And it's just so disappointing because conceptually there's just so much good stuff going on, and visually there's a ton of really beautiful like CGI and stuff in it, and even some good puppet work and costume work and things like that, but just a lot of hey, we're going to establish that like fairy tales always focus on gender and looks, and that's not good, you shouldn't just focus on this. But then also like reinforcing a lot of that bullshit through a lot of the storytelling that's going on, like in trying to call it out, they kind of, it's that problem that bad satire always has, is that you're trying to make a joke about this thing, but really all you're doing is just like embracing this thing. And good satire can do both. Bad satire always falls into a trap, you know.
Speaking of good versus bad satire, Disenchanted dropped in the day after we dropped our Enchanted episode. Have you gotten a chance to check that one out yet, Seajim?
No, that's another one on the Disney, on the Christmas list.
All right, cool. So I'm going to hold off on that, but I have a take on that movie that I haven't gotten to share with anybody yet. I'm interested until after you see it, because you want to talk about good satire, bad satire, and the sins of Disney. That movie has got a lot to answer for me.
Yeah.
So we will.
Well, like I said, this is, it's not, yeah, like we definitely can talk about that, but like, I, you know, it's important that we recognize that that's not just a Disney problem, right? Like, it's an entertainment.
Oh, it's an entertainment problem in general. It's pretty big, and it's something that, like, I've read a lot of takes on the film, and nobody else seems to have connected on the same, like, hook I decided to. And I think it's honestly because we had just watched the first movie, and I can celebrate that that is good satire. Disenchanted feels like it's pushing an agenda, and that is interesting to me. But we'll get there. We can hold off on that. I have seen The Guardians of the Galaxy. I'll wait until you see that. Loved it. I'm probably going to watch it like four more times before Christmas. So that's
these
good.
Special presentations, man. This format of theirs are really, really cool.
I really want more of them. Like, Werewolf by Night was fantastic. The holiday special was really good. An hour in the MCU telling a story so that, like, you have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's really great constraints for these films to have to exist within. Yeah. And I want more of it. Also, I think technically that means Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special is the first official Phase 5 entry since Wakanda Forever closed the book on Phase 4.
I mean, what are we thinking about Werewolf by Night? As mentioned earlier, the fate of that project seems to just be we're going to exist in a nebulous, forgotten realm. But like, does that? Do we feel like that might be something Phase 5 worthy? I don't know.
I think it would be Phase 4. I mean, just because the way that they speak on things, the way that Disney and Marvel approach these things, with them saying Wakanda Forever is the end of Phase 4, and Werewolf by Night existing within the Phase 4 constraints of between WandaVision and Wakanda Forever, I think it would work. And I think it also kind of fits into Phase 4 because, like, think about those movies in, like, Phase 2, sort of like Guardians of the Galaxy, that introduce you to a whole other side of the universe that we haven't seen yet, but then is going to play into what's coming and what's going to be focused on in the next phase.
Yeah.
So I feel like Werewolf by Night was an introduction of a horror side of Marvel. It, by all accounts, doesn't seem to have been... Everybody who's seen it seems to have loved it, but not everybody has seen it. And some people don't even know that it exists. But it really feels like a good way to establish so that when the Blade movie comes down, they can be like, oh yeah, no, horror has always existed in the MCU. It's just in the dark, like, shadows the Dark Shadows reference of what's going on, right? They're
Yeah, I mean,
keeping
and
for
like folding together
themselves.
the characters like Moon Knight and Werewolf by Night and Blade and all that sort of stuff, and how they're going to approach that side of the universe. It also lets us know what they're thinking that looks like. Yeah, I don't want that project to get forgotten, but
Neither
I'm
do I.
excited to
Mostly
dive
because I want
into
Man Thing. I
Guardians.
want more Man Thing. I love Man
Yeah.
Thing. But yeah, but it does feel like I don't know how the special presentations are being looked at, but it is an interesting thing with them being so public about this is the end of Phase 4. That would mean the next Marvel property that releases would be the start of Phase 5, right? So, I don't know. Maybe it's a 4.5. It's a Timon and Pumbaa story.
Yeah, I mean, well, remember, there was always all that talk about how Endgame was going to be the end of that phase, but then obviously Spider-Man,
Is the
No Way
coda.
Home is a very good coda to that, right? And then gets wrapped up in that. Yeah,
Not a
I don't know.
child of deaf adults, but which I'm watching that movie on Saturday, so look forward to a discussion about that coming probably next week. All right, that's a lot of this stuff. Other Christmas things that I've done, and I want to make sure I talk about, but I'm not ready to talk about on the show yet. Christmas Story Christmas dropped. It is available if you have HBO Max, and I watched it immediately before recording today. I had a good time with it, but what I need to insist, right? And it's me. It's just me suggesting to people, don't allow sequel erasure to happen. HBO Max also put up the 2012 sequel to Christmas Story, A Christmas Story 2, where
With
Daniel Stern,
Grodin, right?
no, Grodin is My Summer Story or It Runs in the Family. It goes by two names. That's from 1994. And that
Oh,
has
okay.
actually been rendered non-canonical. They have said that that exists in a separate universe from A Christmas Story. There's
Okay.
also another one in the 80s, 1988. I cannot remember the title of that one because that one was like from the beginning, this is just Jean Shepherd's stories. It is not meant to serve as a sequel. But there's been nine actors who have played Ralphie since A Christmas Story, or maybe even before A Christmas Story, because there's like a black and white adaptation of Jean Shepherd's stories. So that's just a thing to keep in your mind. But Warner Brothers in 2012 did a direct sequel to A Christmas Story. It's Ralphie when he's 15, 43 days from becoming 16 years old. Daniel Stern plays the old man, which is really interesting because I love watching Daniel Stern act.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like he unfortunately got marved by the Home Alone movies, but there's so much more to him. Him in City Slickers. I love the character he portrays in City Slickers. Because
I
he's
mean,
like.
the worst thing that ever happened to him was Very Bad Things. Like that movie really did a number on the people involved in it. And if you weren't somebody that was already established enough to pull yourself out of that mess, like it was a hard time getting out of that film. And I feel like he was just on the wrong side of the line. Like he was not as beloved and established as he maybe should have been at that point in his career, and had a hard time getting past that movie, I think.
That's a very fair read on Daniel Stern. But also Diner. I love him in Diner. He's like the heart of that movie, in a movie full of just fucking jerk asses. I love Diner though. That's a movie that I try to watch almost every Christmas because it's about that whole coming home sort of feeling. But yeah, so don't not watch it. HBO Max, I really respect it that they put up A Christmas Story, A Christmas Story 2, and A Christmas Story Christmas. All of them went up on the same day onto the HBO Max like library. So if you are going to watch Christmas Story Christmas, do yourself a favor because what I will say is like it's sitting at a 3.4 on IMDb based on user ratings, but I feel like people are just upset that there's a sequel at all. I don't,
Yeah.
it's weird because everybody seems to be like excited about Christmas Story Christmas, but having watched both of them this weekend, two is good. I think I enjoyed two a little bit more because it really leaned into the sort of like non-cynical nostalgia that I feel A Christmas Story just thrives in. You know, it's so earnest in the way that it's just remembering what Christmas was like when Jean Shepherd was a child.
Yeah.
And they do a really good job. I mean, it's based on it's all stories from his book, In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash. So It's good. It's enjoyable stuff. But watch it. Don't just jump right into A Christmas Story Christmas, because there are some nice little references to things that happen in that movie. We had a fun time watching the trilogy this weekend as a family. So check them out.
The true lost Daniel Stern project, just to give props to legitimate work that actors did that I don't necessarily love the creator of, is he was also the voice of Dilbert for the 2 years that the Dilbert animated show existed. And that is maybe the number one thing that I will always remember him for. And that's such a shame now that we know everything we know about Scott Adams. but yeah, that was the other big thing that Stern did in his career for me that like I really latched onto.
I didn't know how to fit it in there, Sejan, so I appreciate you just wedging it in at the end, because
I gave him shit about Very Bad Things, but that was actually even before Dilbert, so yeah. Like I just wanted to make sure I gave credit to it.
He's so good in Dilbert, and then Chris Elliott as Dogbert, like those are two guys who are really thought of as like kind of the butts of the joke, and then in that show, the way that they play those characters is so good.
They're the straight men in that show, and they're cynical. They're just as cynical as they need to be, but there's also just a lot of fun in that show. It's a weird thing that, again, like I have no interest in like in giving too much more airtime to because of everything that has gone over the years. But in terms of a late night sitcom animated like show, which you know there was a string there in the late 90s of them just really everybody wanted to grab the next Simpsons and nobody could, right? Dilbert is one of those, is definitely one to acknowledge.
I mean, if it's any consolation, Dilbert is not still going on. The animated Dilbert was only for the 2 years. Weirdly enough, it was an 8 o'clock show on the CW, which I believe was the WB network at the time. Might have even been UPN.
I think UPN.
Which is where I was watching it and loving it. But one of the reasons why it stopped is because Scott Adams was like, I don't like it. I don't like the show.
I don't like what it's doing to my characters.
So understand that, like, liking the Dilbert animated series. I don't like how I just said animated. But liking that series is a pretty good way to stick it to Scott Adams.
Excellent.
Like, understand that, good. Like, small acts of rebellion, that's definitely one of them.
Nice.
All right. So, in the time since we last recorded, I went on a magical journey, Sejan. And it's journey that I'm not 100% ready to share yet. I haven't finished the game, though
I was going to ask, what did you do, acid for the first time?
No. I don't know if I'll ever drop acid. I had a really weird experience with acid my freshman year of college, where I was going to go volunteer at Bonnaroo. I was going to work as like the litter corps people at Bonnaroo, which got you into Bonnaroo 2 days early so that you could help them set everything up. So you'd have like the best location for your tent and everything. And then you left Bonnaroo 2 days later, but you didn't have to pay to get into the show. You'd still get to see everything for free. And like, you didn't have to work during it. They're like, we know that trash is just going to be part of it, but we need 2 full days from you to clean this up.
Yeah, so like, well, and then, I mean, you're also not mentioning that getting in early and leaving late means you're also not dealing with fucking the crowd trying to move in and out of Bonnaroo.
Yeah.
2 days, you would have wanted that anyway.
Right. It was this wonderful opportunity that I got to do, but the person that I was going down there with, I had just gotten my license, or it was prior to me getting my license. I think I got my license in the spring of freshman year, so I had just gotten my license, but I was not prepared to drive down to Tennessee on my own, and a friend of mine had got to started up on the thing. So when we got into his car, he dropped acid for the drive, and then, like, I just got out of the car, and I'm like, have fun. I can't drive to Tennessee with you while you're on acid. And, you know, my initial thought would then be, well, I could drive, but he drove a manual, and I did not know how to drive a manual car, and I wasn't about to do that down to Tennessee.
You didn't want to learn that from a guy on acid on your way down to Tennessee?
No, it didn't seem like the right thing to do. But, like, I don't think I made the wrong decision, is what I'm going to say, but it has always...
In terms of your own self-care, no, but yeah. In terms of quality of content for this show a decade later, you really, really should have been thinking about that.
I mean, though. I did get to go to music festivals. That's how I met Danny Tamborelli and had some fun in his tent. not acid related, but maybe some of acid's brothers and sisters
Just it
were.
does sound like you and Danny Tamborelli had a sordid affair during Bonnaroo. I
It
want you to
wasn't Bon.
acknowledge that
It
that's what
wasn't
you just
Bonnaroo.
said.
It was another a Northeastern festival. Maybe it was a sordid affair. Whatever. He saw me. He invited me into his tent. You know what happens from there behind flap doors? That's between me and Daniel Tamborelli. I don't even know anymore. But yeah, no. So S is one of those things that like I'm probably never going to do just because I have that weird memory of it. Also, I'm older now. Like I feel like acid is a young man's drug. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't really know anything about it.
Look, one day we will have the drug episode, but we're nowhere near 420 yet, so we'll wait till then.
Oh man, stupid pandemic. We would have done it before 2020. No, that would have been weird. Maybe we do it for 24, right? 2024, because then it's 4224, and then like it's the same.
Nah, you gotta wait till 2069.
Oh yeah, nice. What are we
Get all the
talking
dumb
about?
numbers.
Well, all the numbers you cannot bid in Jeopardy, which is just hilarious to me. Freaking Jeopardy.
Didn't know that.
Yeah,
All right,
no,
we'll
they
talk
like
about
there was
that
a whole big
later.
thing
Hold
about
on.
it. Yeah, no. The magical journey I took was to the land of Paldea via the vessel of Pokemon Scarlet and Violet. Specifically, I'm playing on Scarlet. I have collected all of the badges in the game, which unlike other Pokemon games, except for nope, this is the one that has the most badges. Because Pokemon Gold and Silver had 16 badges. This one has 18 badges. 8 of them for baiting gyms. 5 of them for defeating the Titans in the world, which are kind of like Shadow of the Colossus Colossi. And they represent sort of the hidden machines and maneuvers from the other earlier Pokemon games. And then 5 of them for destroying Team Star, which is the like Team Rocket of this particular generation. I've done all those. I've gotten all that stuff. And now I have the final boss of the gym journey and the Titan journey that I still need to beat. I completed the Star Journey. And I have to say something about Pokemon. First of all, everything that you're reading on the internet about it being janky as all hell, that's 100% true. That is not being over-exaggerated in any way, shape, or form. The game should not have been released. And it's really sad that they sold 10 million copies in 3 days, because you learn the wrong lesson from that. Which is, we can sell them anything and they're just gonna buy it. No, we bought it because the name was Pokemon. And then after that, we played it and we're like, wow, this is fucking janky as shit. This does not look good. This does not play good. Like, it's weird. All of that stuff is true. Doesn't change the fact that I've had some fun in the game, but it is the first full-on open-world Pokemon experience. And hoo boy, are there some growing pains with that.
So wait a minute. Talk to me about that in terms of our Arceus then, or Arceus. How do you say that?
Arceus?
I've
Arceus?
just realized I've always seen it spelled, never said it out loud. But I thought that was supposed to be like Breath of the Wild, open worldy.
So
Am I
the
misreading
reason
that
why
or?
I that one is not an open world is that there's a hub town that you go to. And then you speak to somebody in the hub town, and then you can go to one of 5 separate biomes.
Oh, so
So
there's
in
not
the.
like a world in between.
Yeah. So you
Okay.
go to the hub town, and then you're like, I want to go to the snow area. And you go to the snow area. And then the snow area is a big open area that you can explore, but you can't go from the snow area to like the beach area. There's no way to
Okay.
do that without
Yeah, I mean
talking to
these are like when
somebody.
people argue about things like is Mario Galaxy open world and all that because you can go back and forth between planets and it's like not really. It's still a guided experience or a rage when people were like, we were promised an open world game and that's not what rage is.
Yeah. I mean, Mario Odyssey is would be that. Like Mario Galaxy is very much you
Right,
have the
Odyssey is what
hub
I
of
meant.
yeah.
I said
Yeah.
Galaxy. Yeah, no, I said Galaxy, but I meant Odyssey.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But
with like the
even
different
then,
worlds.
Odyssey does have that really cool thing where if you find the pictures, you can go from 2 connected worlds. That is really cool. But that doesn't happen till like near the end of the game unless you know, there's a clip through in I think the Jurassic Kingdom that can take you to the Ice Kingdom, and
Yeah.
that's part of the
No,
speed
the
run.
bigger
Yeah.
thing is eventually you get to a point where you're challenging yourself to try and get around as much as possible without using
Without using the ship, yeah.
the ship, mainly so that you don't get cutscenes. But okay, so this one is more traditional in
This one
that
is
regard of
more,
like.
congratulations, you're in this world, you can go wherever you want.
Okay.
And
They got those like death claws stopping you from going to North Vegas yet, or like can you
no,
basically go wherever you want?
you
Like you
can
can.
basically go anywhere that you want.
Okay.
Trainer
All right.
battles are now optional. If you talk to a trainer, that's the only way that you're going to have to fight them. They can't like see you from across the way and be like, our eyes met, you have to fight me. In fact, there's like a little joke about that where someone's like, a trainer can't force you to battle. That would be wrong. And it's like, oh, you should tell the other eight generations of Pokemon games that, because that was not the case. And it's so it's a full open world experience, but the death claws stopping you from going to North Haven or whatever you said, because I've never gotten that far into any of the Fallout games. Sorry, Sijin. I swear that I've
Literally 2 minutes
tried.
into New Vegas, never gotten
Oh,
that far in. You mean
I've
you've
never
never
played New
started a Fallout
Vegas.
game?
I've never played New Vegas. I've played Fallout 3 and Fallout
Right.
4. I've never played New
Well,
Vegas.
famously in New Vegas, if you if they tell you you can go anywhere you want, but they're pretty adamant that you should stick to this one particular path, but like you can go anywhere you want, and if you really do try to deviate from that initial path, they send a Deathclaw to kill you pretty much instantly. And it's like this like really famous thing of like, yeah, it's an open world and you can do whatever you want unless we want to fuck with you. Like it's like this weird balance of is it really open world if the game is stopping you in this way? But then there are people that are like, well, you could also just kill the Deathclaw, which is a thing, not that easy, right? So it's this it is an interesting conversation. Like the world is open, you are allowed to do whatever you want, but there are these kind of arbitrary limits. One of the ones that you have played that's more like this is Breath of the Wild, right? That idea being like you can go right to the castle and kill Ganon if you want, but it's not going to be easy right now. You can do all of this other stuff to level yourself up, get better gear, all of this, and then go do it. But it is available for you to just run there if you want. And so there's this conversation of like, what does open world mean when there are certain things in your way, and what counts as an obstacle versus straight up just like an impenetrable wall, right? Like there's all that sort of stuff. So like, is there really nothing like that? Like, if you really want to, you can just go where you want, or do you have to like, oh, in order to get off this island, you have to build a boat though. So like, it's open world, but there's things stopping you every step of the way.
So, Breath of the Wild is probably the closest analog, which is not really surprising, where there is about 90 minutes to 2 hours of game that you have to get through before you're truly at the open world experience. Because the whole setup of the story is that you're a new student at this academy of Pokemon trainers. And you have to go from your house, you have to walk to the academy, and that's where you meet like the dragon that eventually becomes your mount to like explore around the world. So that whole experience going from your house to the academy, that takes about an hour. And then depending on how much you mash through all of the tech scenes in the academy, like there's so much setup in this game. The best descriptor I've seen is that every Pokemon game has that sort of tutorial area. This one literally feels like I'm at the DMV. And I'm like, that's a really good point. Because it was like, it got to the point where I'm like, I don't even know if I want to keep playing you game. Because I'd have no desire to go to school. And then at the end of all the school stuff, where that you just wasted about like 30 minutes of my time, they're like, all right, now on your year-long assignment, your independent study, go out and explore the world and make your own treasure. And it's like, go fuck yourself. I swear to God.
This is how disconnected from Pokemon in general I am, but like we talked a little bit before this one came out. Is this going to be the one Seijin plays? Seijin's not sure. He's going to wait how people feel about it. And then the inevitable cycle of, oh, it came out and people hate it. No thanks. I'll wait till the next one. Like, I'm still not turned off from Pokemon in general. I just have no desire for this to be the one I spend my precious money on or time, right? I was under the impression, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is a remake of an older game,
No,
yes?
this is brand new. This is the
So
first
these are
entry into
brand new.
Gen 9. Yes.
So there's not even the excuse of them falling back on like just older stuff that we were doing. This is brand new. This has never been seen before. Worlds, new Pokemon then, like new
I mean,
starters, new.
there's always carryover Pokemon, but this game of all the newer ones does have an extensive list of brand new fucking Pokemon for you to find.
So yeah, so that's, and I think that's maybe something that I was misunderstanding about a lot of this criticism is I somehow along the way had gotten the impression that these were like up-reses or remakes of older versions that they were putting out. And so the criticism of this looks like, dirt on this on the Switch, I was just assuming it was because a lot of stuff of them just having to bring stuff up from older systems, but they don't even have that. So this is just like whole hog just feels like an embarrassment.
So a lot of the reason why people say this game looks like dirt and it doesn't look great on the Switch, the game's leaked like 2 weeks before the Switch came out. So you could get the
A Switch came out or
ROMs
the game came out? Sorry.
before the game came out for the Switch, right?
Yeah, I
The
gotcha. Yep.
someone was able to get a copy of the game. They dumped the ROM, they put it online, and Switch emulators are better than the Nintendo Switch because they're able to borrow from all the processing power that could possibly be there for the in the PC to make the game play well. So anything that you were seeing about this game, from pirates or whatever, was stuff that was scaled up and looked better because it was getting to use the full processing power of a personal computer as opposed to like the Integra chip that is there on the Nintendo Switch. So the game looked gorgeous for 2 weeks, and then you played it on the Switch and you notice all of these issues that exist within the game because it's just too intensive for the Switch to handle.
So stupid. Yeah, I think that that was some of the stuff I was seeing. It was people talking about if it had the processing power because people were taking screenshots of it on their PCs from like comparing it to like a PS5 or an Xbox. And people were just like, can't do that though. You gotta actually consider what the Switch is actually capable of. And people are like, so what's worse? They bought this game that has the potential to look really good. The Switch just isn't there. Or the fact that like they didn't build the game to the system, it was the only system it was going to be released on, right? Because like unless they plan on doing a PlayStation 5 release, it doesn't matter that the PlayStation 5 processing power would make it look better, right? So I guess the thing is like I've been hearing it as this online debate of is this because the game is bad or the Switch is bad? And I don't know. I mean, like I feel like the Switch is capable of what the Switch is capable of. You should, and if that's going to be the only system you put your game out on, that's what you should be designing to in terms of specs, right? Like, it seems weird to me that that there's this. I mean, it's the Pokemon defenders. There's always going to be. I mean, and this is true of any fandom, but there's always going to be those people that defend the game at no cost. Like, no matter what, they're going to be the ones that say it's not the game's fault, and that camp right now is very happy to talk about the limitations of the Switch in that regard, as if that's the reason why the game looks like butt. But like, it's not. This is not a cross-platform game. This is the platform it is going to be on. Why would they not aim for those specs? I don't understand that.
And what it seems like is because they didn't have the time to work the game out for the system. They had the deadline, they built and were able to match that deadline, but then they didn't get to test it and see, oh wow, like the frame rate is really chuggy. Or like there are moments where there are people walking in the background of conversations and it just looks like a clip show, like clip art moving PowerPoint sort of slideshow BS. And it's just
Think of that
like,
moment in Family Guy where they're like, we ran out of money, and that's just Peter just
da,
like
da, da.
wobbles
Yeah,
across
they
the
just
screen.
moved the cell. Yeah,
Yeah.
it's weird, and that's not great. But then the other issue is that it's their first truly open world game, and it's like they wanted to do it their own way. So from the beginning, as soon as you're cast out from the academy, they mark on you the 18 places you have to go, right? The 5 bases you need to raid and take over, the 8 gyms you need to beat, and the locations where the 5 titans were last seen. Right?
Okay.
Because there is like some weird sort of tracking with them and some puzzles with it. It's like the Titan storyline I really liked, and I ended up really connecting to the Team Star storyline. Like it felt like good anime with the storytelling and everything that was on display there.
Nice.
But for both of them, the big issue is since it's an open world, there is no required order to do things in. So I found the dark guy in the Team Star group, and he was pretty easy to beat. He had like level 20 Pokemon while I was at like level 25, so it felt like, oh, this is good. So then I went and I did all the gyms, but like the first gym I fought, it was like level 20, and again it felt like, oh, this is right, this feels correct. And then I go over to the psychic gym, and no, I went over to the normal gym. That was the second gym that I tried to take down because it was like I just stumbled upon it in my exploration. And the guy had level 50 Pokemon, and I was at level, like, 27. And it's like, well, I cannot beat this character right now. He is too strong. It doesn't matter if I have super effective moves. Just like by the very nature of our levels, I'm not supposed to be here yet. So then what the game turned into me was going to all of the various gyms, because then you unlock fast travel to the towns that they're in, and finding the gyms that, like, I did have the level for at the time. And even then, like, by the time I got to the psychic gym, she was a much higher level than me. And when I fought her as my eighth gym, she still was a higher level than me. Like, there just wasn't enough for me to raise my Pokemon up to be able to beat her. And it feels really strange that, like, it doesn't scale with your progress. Like, when the first gym that you go to, regardless, should be Pokemon in about the 20 level range, right? And then the
I don't know. It's a hard way to go about it, right? Because, like, I think specifically about the opposite of this is what happened with the original Borderlands, where people figured out that it did exactly that. It scaled with your current level. Whenever you discovered an area, it would match your current level. The problem was that the game wouldn't make up for it later, couldn't make up for later. You know, I don't want to act like I just don't think that it was part of the math at the time. By Borderlands 3, you get something more akin to that, where every time you go into an area, the area has a baseline level at which it will exist, but then after that it will scale up. So, like, you can definitely find yourselves in Borderlands 3 hitting an area where you're like, oh, these guys are a little too high for me, I need to come back later. But you'll never go back to an area and feel like these guys are super easy. Not entirely true. There's ways around that with, like, the types, right? The enemy types. But generally, that's how it works. The very first Borderlands, though, it had this real big thing that speedrunners used to exploit the hell out of, where they would try and get from world to world as fast as possible at the lowest level. Then as they leveled up, they would get to a point where they were just wrecking that game, right? It's why there are certain mega bosses in that game that you can't unlock until after you're level 50, because the math of the progression system, if you had gotten into those areas, would have made those big bads, like, low level if you could get in there. And so, like, the game just didn't have that scaling. So video games used to have that opposite problem is what I'm getting at, right? So the idea of having these things that scale with you doesn't introduce this idea of a challenge, but you need more of a carrot, right? Like if you're going to introduce such a big stick, like, there better be some tasty carrots along the way, and it just sounds like it's not giving you that.
Yeah, well, so the original Borderlands was, like, what, 2009? Like let's look at that, right? 2008, 2009, right? Borderlands 3, I think, was 2018, 2000, mm-hmm. We were doing the show at the time when Borderlands 3 came out, right?
Yeah,
so it's one of those situations where, like, there exist other examples of how you could have done it. But then the biggest offender of it all is that in Pokemon Sword and Shield, the other Pokemon generation that came out on the Switch, as you collected gym badges, the wild area, which was sort of the open area of that particular game, and that only existed in one specific thing. And once you got to, like, towns, then it was the more rigid Pokemon structure. Those Pokemon, their levels went up as you collected badges. So the first time you got there, like, the highest level thing you could run into, aside from the, like, big Pokemon, like, there were always level 50 mons that could just rock your shit. But as you collected badges, the baseline of Pokemon that you would find there would go up, like, by 5 levels. So if it starts where, like, 15 is the highest you're going to run into while you're exploring, after you have one gym badge, it goes up to 20. And that way, so it kind of grew with you in this way. So they have the example of that. Ditto with something like Arceus, which was a bigger open world concept. Like, there were still those things that were, like, level 70 the first time you got to the first area. And you're like, well, I have to avoid them, or that's a big threat for me. I just need to know where that is and how to avoid it. But then as you played through the game and you progressed more, stuff kind of grew with you. So it's a thing that, like, other Pokemon games were able to do it. And what I'm talking about is, and it's specifically with the gyms. I would be completely fine if I go to one of the bases and they're like, they have level 60 Pokemon. You came in here with level 5 Pokemon. Good fucking luck. You're not going to win. You're just not going to win. Like, leave and come back when you're ready for this, right? I'm okay with that. I'm fine with that. But the thing about Pokemon is, and has always been, the level of Pokemon that will listen to you is directly tied to how many gym badges you have.
Yeah, what's that? You don't got that badge? Fuck off. Yeah, like, yeah, the Pokemon don't give a shit.
Yeah. So the first Pokemon badge that you get allows you to catch and train Pokemon up to level 25, right? And then every subsequent badge adds 5 more levels to that level cap. So it feels really strange when you're fighting stuff that has, like, level 55 stuff, and you're like, but just based on the amount of badges I have, I don't have, I can't even train things that could compete with you. And you don't let me know that, like, a recommended level for this. And sure, maybe I'm supposed to learn from it and leave, but you can run from every battle, which is nice, but they still treat it like a loss. You just don't have to watch your 6 Pokemon die. So, like, it feels like a weird thing to be like, punish me for playing the game that you wanted me to play, right? Playing the open world adventure, finding a gym, going to fight the gym, and then finding out, oh yeah, but you're not ready for this gym yet. And when you have all that scaling there, right, where, like, Pokemon up to this level will not listen to you unless you have the gym badges to back it up, I feel like it'd be pretty easy to be like, all right, so the first gym that you go to, this is the level of the Pokemon. The second gym you go to, regardless, this is the high level of those Pokemon. So you can still challenge yourself with it. It just seems like a weird thing that, like, they all have static levels. It seems like a weird thing for the gyms specifically. The Titans having static levels makes sense to me because some Titans are going to be a bigger threat than other Titans. The big bird at the top of the cliff, that's fine. That, like, that's a level 30 Pokemon. You get there about the time where you can take down a level 30 Pokemon. The dragon, the, like, ancient dragon that you find, that being a level 50 Pokemon, and it being the only Titan, spoilers for Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, that has 3 different, like, phases to that fight. Like, it feels like this is the last one that you're supposed to fight. Like, it feels like you need to train to get to this. And that's fine, right? But for the gyms to be static levels just feels like we have all of this experience of open world games and you guys just ignored it.
Yeah. And I will say that I've been playing a pseudo open world game recently from Nintendo in Mario Rabbids, right? Mm-hmm. And they do this weird balance where there's like 2 or 3 particular types of characters, villain, like baddies in a level that will level with you. So, you know, but mostly the baddies in a level will stay pretty static. But to that point, you have a couple of different things. First of all, you can see everything on the map. So there's no, like, surprise fights. It's not like, oh, it popped out of tall grass or some nonsense like that. And in that, there are ways that they give you to avoid them. They show you, like, you can just walk down this street here and you'll run into 2 or 3 things. Or you can sneak up through the building this way and then you can avoid. They give you ways to avoid it. Also, they let you run away. There's a run move where if somebody sees you, you have the opportunity to get far enough away and they're leashed. So they don't follow you for too long. They go back to their walking pattern or whatever. So there's a lot of ways around that kind of stuff. So if you don't want to fight a bunch of low level stuff to waste your time, very easy. Or if you see something huge that you're like, I can't take that on right now, very easy to avoid. It's up to you how much fighting you want to do. And then in that regard, you know, the length of the game is also really beneficial in that. I played that game for 40 something hours, but you could finish that game in 25 conservatively, right? Like, if you were just paying attention to just story stuff and really, like, nose to the grindstone, just going, you could finish that game in 25 hours. Meaning that by the time you get to a couple of fights where you feel like some of this nonsense is starting to go on because you've leveled up so much and all of that, the game's pretty much over at that point. And so, like, it's okay. Like, there's a certain amount of bullshit that you'll put up with for a little bit of time because it makes sense in the mechanics of the game. But you get to the end of the game, you're done with it. You never think about that again. Whereas Pokemon, I know people have been spending 50 hours with it and feeling this way about it. And it's just like, yeah, you're not even done yet. So, like, there is also something to that too, right? So it's really interesting to see a company like Ubisoft and Nintendo working on this one and the ways in which they approach that kind of concept versus something like Game Freak and Nintendo. And clearly Game Freak has their opinions about how that stuff is supposed to work. It's just, it's your experience here is not one that I've heard this from other people, you know?
Yeah, and that's really the thing, because I have a friend who's like, oh, like, I'm fighting this character. I didn't realize it was supposed to be post-game content. And I asked him, which, like, can I ask, like, are you talking like you already beat him the one time? And he's like, no, after I beat all the Titans, the guy that I fight, he's so much stronger than me. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't think it's supposed to be post-game. I think it's just supposed to be, by the time you get there beating all the Titans, you should be able to handle him. But, like, yeah, that's just not how the game is built. Like, the game.
Oh, that's the other thing
that
about
you
Mario
have a
Rabbids
different
is
length to it. Like,
yeah, and the other thing about Mario Rabbids is every character is walking around with a very clearly posted level and health bar above their head that you can turn off if you want, to their credit in the UI. But if you want it there so that you can see stuff from a mile away and go, I'm not stepping near that level 40 character because I'm only level 13 right now, or vice versa, I'm level 40 and have no interest in going through this gauntlet of level 6 Goombas, so I'm going to, like, avoid it at all costs. So you can see that. There's also that element to it as well. It sounds like maybe that's not something that's very clear to you until you walk up
until
to somebody,
you
though.
Start a fight, like, that's oof, the thing. And oof, the really crazy thing about it is this character who's like, I need to see if you're ready to do this thing, I'm going to be your final challenge to confirm you're ready to take on what's going on in there. Like, he helped me in all the fights, and in all of those fights against Titans, his Pokemon would die. Like, his Pokemon would faint. They were not ready for those fights. So, like, when I then fight him and he's got, like, level 60 Pokemon, it's like, what the hell was going on in all those other fights then?
Yeah.
What is the balance here? Like, I thought that I was ready to take you down because I took down Titans that were, like, twice my level, knowing, like, super effective moves and just, like, the right way to attack them to make it beneficial to me. And then I fight you and it's like, oh no, my Greedent's level 58. And it's like,
yeah,
there was no indication of that when we were fighting alongside each other.
And to that, right, like to your stuff from earlier, like, narratively, it's just really wild. Like, what is the narrative reason why your this character has a level 60 version of this when I've been fighting level 50 Pokemon that are 1,000 times bigger and scarier? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's my biggest thing is that, like, the scaling of the open world doesn't feel right. And this is, and Dale loves Pokemon, right? And I'm going to share her thing. The game to Dale, who will play this game probably into the end of time, right? She'll be playing this game forever. She feels that they've just raised the levels in order to inflate the challenge. And I know that's been the conversation that I feel we've always had on this show, is like, how to make a game challenging without just turning the enemies into damage sponges.
Yeah.
And in a game like Pokemon, the way that you make it difficult is, you know, you're fighting the ice gym, and then lo and behold, the final Pokemon has, like, a water move, despite it being an ice type Pokemon. So you go in with a fire type thinking that you're going to rock shit, and then you get to the final guy and they're like, surf, and you die. Like, that's the way to do it, yeah. Where, like, you're like them using moves that you're not expecting, or them acting in ways that are different. Just raising everybody's level and making them have huge HP pools, like, that just feels like an inflation. I don't know.
And there are games where that makes sense, right? Like we can talk about how that's bullshit all we want, but the two of us have been playing so much Vampire Survivors lately. We're in that game, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, and but that is what that game excels at, is creating these sponges that become spongier and spongier, and you better keep up until you can't anymore, right? Like, that's the gameplay loop of those specific types of games. I mean, we mentioned Borderlands earlier. I love those games, and one of the reasons I do is I love, with all of the stuff that they've done with, like, chaos levels and stuff and things like that, like, you up that shit and you go in and you just make it crazier and harder to the point where either you melt, your PlayStation melts, or your character melts. Who will it be first? Like, there's a ton of really obvious games where really popular games, I mean, where that is obviously on display, and it works for those. But when we're doing Pokemon and there's this, like, narrative element to it, and there's this joy that's supposed to be coming from it, it feels like it's a very weird like, kind of pullover from more of those, like, get good style games than it is from Pokemon.
Definitely. That's a really interesting way of looking at it. I don't know. I mean, everybody has said Pokemon needs to be more difficult, and that's why things like Nuzlocke or Ironmon exist, right? Taking the older games that we all have deemed too easy. I mean, they're really too easy because we've played them 1,000 times, so we know what to expect and how to overcome those things. But, like, yeah, making a Pokemon game harder by enforcing rules on yourself. So then to play this game that just, like, is hard, but it doesn't really feel like a fair difficulty. It sort of feels like an exploitive one. I mean,
well, because I think, like, you were not somebody that wanted Pokemon to get harder. That's the other thing too, right? Is yeah, you're saying that there's all these people out there that wanted Pokemon to get harder, so they created things like Nuzlocke and stuff. And having the ability for the game to work for them in some ways is great. Having those options available is great, but that's not necessarily what everybody else wanted. I think the main thing that people want from Pokemon right now is something fresh. And I think that's the biggest issue, is not that all of this stuff feels like they're taking the shit that's already there and just cranking it up to 11 and hoping that's what people are going to buy into. Here's more Pokemon. Here's more difficulty. Here's more gyms. Here's more, like, all of that sort of stuff. And it's like, no, I think the big thing that we've learned about Pokemon over the years is that the most joyful reception to Pokemon games are always the ones that do something wild and new. Even if it's something as crazy as Pokemon Snap, it's so different from Pokemon, people adore it. You know, like there's this... Pokemon, I mean, look at, like, Pokemon Eevee, right? Like the Pokemon Go, right? Like those things are beloved within the community because there's something different and new. And then every time they try and go back to the old formula and just, like, crank it, they get shit on. And they just don't seem to be learning from that.
Yeah. It's a weird one. And I think one of the other reasons why, like, thinking about the inflated difficulty and damage sponges and all of that is we are on the eve, like, by the next time we record an episode of the Say Report,
it's Eevee.
by the next time we record an episode of the Say Report, I should have played River City Girls 2. I broke down. I pre-ordered a copy from Japan. And by all accounts, I mean, they released a trailer on Thanksgiving saying that it was coming out on the 1st of December. So I should have it by the next time we record an episode. And I'm very excited for that. But then, like, the big complaint that I have about River City Girls the first is the fact that, like, all of the villains level up with you. How you level up your girl also makes every single character in the game stronger. And that is, like, it becomes not fun when, like, especially when you have varieties of enemies, right? Like, it makes sense that the robot Terminator-esque guys are very difficult when you fight them. But when schoolboys and schoolgirls that you were beaten in the first level are just as big a threat, it just feels like, why am I even bothering making my character stronger?
No, I mean, at some point there needs to be that reward. There needs to be some carrot with your stick, right? You need to feel like I put in the time and the effort. I am now powerful and better at this game. I should be able to mow down some of these baddies from the beginning that you need to get to a point where you are OP a little bit. Getting too overpowered can also be a problem, but, like, in some ways I'd rather have that. I'd rather have a moment where I am so overpowered I almost feel like, oh, I'm invincible. Like, nothing matters anymore. I would love to have a moment or two of that. Way over, oh man, I feel like this game just doesn't want me to get anything.
Yeah, in fact, for me, and I know that this is not the way that it works for everybody, so I will admit that right from the beginning, when I hit that level of, oh my god, I'm so overpowered, then I have to look at the game and be like, do I want to keep playing like this, or do I want to look into how I can adjust this experience so I can still find joy from it? And that's what I did with River City Girls, right? By the time you have the tank bunny and the tank button and the bunny button, and you can literally one hit any enemy, it's one of those situations where, like, yeah, but if I don't wear those, I can still have fun with the game.
Right.
But if I just want to race through the game, killing everything with one shot and feeling like the badass I am after playing it, like, for 60 hours, that's nice. Options. It's all about options. And from what you said about Rabbids, it seems like they gave that to you.
They do, not as much as they maybe should, but again, the game doesn't run long enough for you to really ever get marred down by it. If it was a longer game, there's a lot of stuff in it that I would have more criticism about. But the fact that it's such a nice, tight experience that I was able to finish up in 40 hours, there's a lot of stuff that I was willing to forgive. We'll talk more about Rabbids someday, though, because there's a lot more I want to say about it.
Yeah, and we're getting to the end of this particular journey into our minds that is the 306th episode of the Say Report. But it's been a good one. It's been a good time. And again, as I finish Pokemon, maybe my ideas about it will change and shift. But right now, like, you give me three separate paths to follow, for all three paths to pretty much feel the same was a bit disappointing. Like, again, they have the bases, and it would make sense if, like, this base, you have to be level 30 to even hope to win. This base, 40, 50, 55, 60. You know?
Well, it also feels like, in all of this conversation, what's really interesting is this is, it's been a long time coming, but Pokemon has been moving so far away from the idea of types for so long that, like, they're still important at, like, a meta level and, like, an advanced level, but it also feels like there's no exploration in that sense. Like, if you choose this particular type of starter, like, having the first gym everybody go to, but then after that it breaks off into areas where you could go, it feels like it would be very much geared towards, well, what types do I have? So that's clearly the next gym I will go to, is whatever one I can go to with this particular type, or something I've caught since that has, like, taught me about a new type that I should... The idea that, like, that whole side of the conversation, I'm not hearing anybody have it. We haven't had it once today, as you and I've talked about it, and I've not heard anybody else talk about that whole concept. And that's, like, a huge part of the Pokemon formula that just seems absent right now.
The only discussion that I've seen about it is the fact that Nuzlockers, right, because they're working on their meta for how they want to play the game, want to outlaw the fire starter from being used, because it has a type advantage over 5 of the 8 gyms.
Wow.
And it's the fact that, like, yeah, because it's strong against bug, it's strong against ice, it's strong against grass, it's strong against, I'm trying to think of the other two, ghost,
yeah,
because it's a ghost-type Pokemon as well, and it's strong against, I don't remember the last
psychic
one.
Psychic or something?
No. Well, psychic, yeah, because it's ghost-type. So, like, by eventually it becomes a fire ghost Pokemon. So you have that ghost advantage over those. And then
that's,
like,
wild.
Yeah.
But I will say, man, that's like a failure in language, because like not allowing Nuzlockes with that type, with that starter, from what you're explaining, makes total sense, because of the idea that if that one is allowed, then it's going to be the only one anybody ever uses, right? Is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
And so saying, like, well, doing a Nuzlocke with that character is fine, but doing a Nuzlocke with one of the others is an even crazier challenge, is really more the way to talk about it. But the way that community is set up, the idea of them calling out and being like, no, it's just in the rules, actually makes it sounds just like them.
Yeah, right. But it's just one of those situations where
we live in a society.
Wow. I mean, honestly, if you want the biggest challenge, you go with the water type Pokemon, because it doesn't even have any real gym advantages.
Yeah.
Because eventually it becomes fighting, so you have, like, an advantage over the normal type gym, but the fire one is a base, and those are not required to beat the Pokemon League, which is what I think they're determining as the end game for them. Again, I have no idea what the end of this game is, because the whole thing was there are three paths to follow to victory. So, like, by beating all the bases and finishing that storyline, on some level, I've finished Pokemon Scarlet and Violet based on the marketing and everything that they've said, but I don't feel like I've finished it, because I have the Titan mission, I have that guy to beat, and I still have the Pokemon League. It's just very interesting the way that it is coded within everything.
Yeah, wild stuff, man.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to do. And I guess the last thing is that, like, as annoying as forced trainer battles were, it allowed you to level up your Pokemon by having fights that you couldn't avoid.
Forced you to level up your Pokemon. I get what you're saying.
But it's one of those situations where, like, because you're fighting, your Pokemon should be leveling up. But by everything kind of being an option now, like, you could wind up at the end of the game with very weak Pokemon.
Yeah.
And then they have the whole candy system, and it's like, that sort of feels like cheating to take the candies that I've earned from my raid battles, but at the same time, it feels like it's what you're telling me to do. It seems like what you're advocating in order to just raise the level of the Mon.
I haven't played the game, so take this with a grain of salt. But if a game, but if a system is ever introduced, it never by the game itself, it never feels like cheating to me. I understand where that. Something going on in my house right now. I understand where that attitude can come from, but like if the game wants to encourage that system, I don't know if I would feel bad using it.
I mean, I think it comes from the purity of the fact that you're supposed to be training your Pokemon, and does not it just, really feel like training if you're like, eat this shit so you'll be powerful? Like, that's not training. That's not engaging in battles and gaining experience. That's Yeah, eat five of these. Oh, look at that. You're level 48 now. It's weird.
It's wild to me how much of this conversation has really made me feel like we need to talk about Mario Rabbids now, because so much of what you're talking about are systems that are in place on a much more micro scale in that game, and they work really well. But again, I really do think it is because of that micro nature of that whole game, like the tight experience, the limited number of characters you're dealing with, all of this stuff, though. Like, you talk about, like, feeding candy instead, and all I can think of is the sparks system in that game, and we'll have to have a larger conversation, obviously.
And I'm fine with that. It's a game I'm interested in. I just really don't want to give money to Ubisoft. Like, I can't justify that at this point in my life.
I mean, at this point, I don't think we should be giving money to them, Game Freak, any of these motherfuckers.
Yeah, that's a solid argument, and also something we can explore in a later episode. Anything else you want to add, Siegen, before we finish this one off?
The big thing that I did this week that I want to give everybody else an opportunity to do before you and I break it down, this includes you, as I don't think you've done this either, is if you are a Steam member, the Game Awards for Steam, that, as far as I can tell, are some of the first ones that I've really been aware of. I'm sure that they've existed before, but it's wild that, like, they're making a really big deal out of them this year on the store page. Bit of a pain in the ass to get into them, though. Just pick a game, any game you like, and then on that game's page, there will be a way to get into the Steam Awards to nominate the game or other games. And everybody should go through and go through and do them, because it's a true People's Choice award for these games. Really interesting stuff came out this year. And I really want to talk to Dev about our lists and what's on it. There's some weird mechanics to the Game of the Year award stuff I don't love, but more on that after we all do them.
Cool. So that's something to look forward to next episode. I guess I've been on a real Steve Martin kick. I think that has to do with the fact that Mixed Nuts is what we're going to be looking at for the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe in December.
I figured that's where it started, yeah.
So, but like Sergeant
Bilko. Did you do Roxanne yet?
I haven't done Roxanne. I really want to.
A weird one.
But yeah, but Sergeant Bilko is one of those movies that just like sort of lives rent-free in my head, because it's part of that trifecta of the like screwball military comedies that came out in the 90s, which we've established before as Sergeant Bilko, McHale's Navy, and Down Periscope, which is always weird. I feel weird whenever I say that, because Down Periscope, by all accounts, is wholly original, and then the other two are remakes of old TV shows.
Right.
But God, that's a lean night, to borrow unforgivable terminology. Like, I love McHale's Navy, and that's not available anywhere right now. But like Tom Arnold is so good as McHale.
I mean, what it comes down to is McHale's Navy and Sergeant Bilko were probably sitting on a shelf somewhere, right? Somebody had written like film versions of those, and when Down Periscope came out, everybody else, as what often in Hollywood, where they were like, "Where's our version of that?" Like, they just pointed at their script on the shelf and they made them. That's probably what happened.
Yeah, but great cast, and Steve Martin as Sergeant Bilko, and then all the actors that are in that stuff, like Pam Adlin, one of her early roles. It's a fun movie. I mean, you got Dan Aykroyd, so that was fun. And then the other, like, big Steve Martin one I did, obviously, because it was Thanksgiving, it's the 35th anniversary of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And to celebrate that, because apparently the 35th anniversary is the meaningful anniversary, and, you know, the dark side of that coin is the fact that I think a lot of these companies aren't sure if we're going to make it to the 40th anniversary, just with everything that's going on in the world. So let's celebrate while we can. But for the 35th anniversary, they dropped the 4K transfer of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It is gorgeous. Oh, my God. High definite. I'm watching it on the PlayStation 5.
Who's the director on that?
Yeah, John Hughes. It's John Hughes' John Candy cycle begins.
Yeah.
With that film. Oh, God, I love that. I love Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. It's just a very enjoyable film. If you haven't seen it in a while, go back to it, revisit it. But the real reason why I actually went out and picked up a physical DVD, Blu-ray, whatever you want to call it, is because it came with 70 minutes of deleted and extended footage from the movie. It's like a whole other movie, really.
Wild.
And it includes, which has always been around on YouTube, but never in as great clarity as can be on a Blu-ray disc, John Candy eating a hot dog while smoking a cigarette. And that alone was worth the price of admission. So it does feel weird to watch Planes, Trains, and Automobiles after Thanksgiving, but it's something that you should like write on your calendar right now and plan for in 2023, is to go back to Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I think that's everything that I did. Oh, we did Knives Out again to get prepared for Glass Onion.
Yeah, do you think you'll go see it in theaters, or are you gonna just wait for the Netflix
I'm gonna
drop?
wait for the Netflix of it. A, because you know there have been more close calls with COVID like around me in Rhode
Yeah.
Island. Like when it's one thing when like, oh, they're happening in X location, but it's another thing where like, oh no, my friend this just caught it. And
No,
it's
right, of
like,
course.
oh,
It's
okay.
always different when you know somebody, right? That's my
Yeah.
idea.
And I'm like, oh, you know, I it's coming to Netflix for free on the 23rd of December. I think I can just wait. I think I don't need to chance this one.
Yeah.
And so that's just the situation there. But after rewatching Knives Out, I mean, one of the reasons why I hadn't rewatched it was I didn't know how the rewatchability would be. I loved it, and I'm very excited now to go back into that world.
Yeah, no, as somebody that's watched it multiple times myself and ended up with a bootleg script, we'll have to when the new one comes out,
Ooh.
we'll have to talk a little bit more about the original too.
Yeah.
But yeah, I adore that first one, so I'm very excited for the sequel to the point where I do think we might make the effort to go out. We're gonna obviously have to see how things are going after the holiday. I want to give everybody some time to let their COVID gestate. But if it looks like in a week or so that things are still pretty clear, we're probably gonna make the effort to go out and see it because I didn't get to see the first one in theaters. You know, it came out in just that right time where I wasn't going to every movie yet, and then things get kind of funky, and you know, so getting to see this one in theaters feels like if we can do it, I'd love to, but I am also totally willing to wait till the end of the month if I have to. So we'll
Yeah.
see how the world is in a week or two.
It's also weird that like Netflix is Cry in Poverty and they have this movie that if they did do a wide release on it, probably could have helped them out with that, right? Like 600 theaters is fine, but I just don't know.
I
Like
mean, I think
it's
this is an effort for them to make money. I don't think this is them spending money. I think this is a hope that this is going to be the kind of thing that keeps them being able to
going,
do these
right?
kinds of movies.
I
Yeah.
don't know. It's just I don't know. I
It
have
could
a
also
lot
be a
of thoughts
contract
about
thing. I
Knives
mean,
Out. That's true. Yeah.
yeah. So we'll have to talk more about it because there's a whole bunch of wrapped up in the whole like Netflix suddenly getting the not just one but two sequels to this movie under contract and stuff and you know.
Yeah. Well, we'll see, and it'll be fun to discuss once we've both experienced the glass onion, which Beatles again, right? So that's fun. If you happen to have a Beatles reference, you're still on Twitter, right? Like I feel weird about it, but then
Actually,
like
I am not. I forgot. Good call out, though.
Okay.
Yeah, officially no longer on Twitter. Sorry, folks. I nuked it the other day. Nuked it, and then the very next morning, Elon Musk was like, "I'm opening the doors for everyone to come back." And I was like, "Sorry, just left." So,
Okay.
yeah. So I'm no
So
longer on Twitter.
I guess if you want to talk to Sijin about anything, you can still get me on Twitter. I'm still part of the problem.
We're going to
At
look into other means of
yeah.
talking to me,
Well,
because we might have to be looking into something like maybe setting up a Say Report Discord or something.
yeah, that'll be interesting, and we'll have that discussion. But for now, if you want to talk to Sijin about anything, I'm still available at Devin D. Decker on Twitter, and just hashtag for Sijin. Numeral for Sijin was his.
And we do have an at Say Report, right?
Yeah, there's at the Say Report, and I'm still
Yeah.
checking that every so often too. So, I mean, I check it every day. Like I act like I don't check it every day, but yeah. But yeah, I'm still. You can still contact me directly at Devin D. Decker is what I'm saying. But you know, and if you're talking to that and you want to make sure I bring it up with Sijin, hashtag for Sijin. But I guess congratulations, Siege. It was one of those moments that I got to be honest, when I re-listened to our time capsule episode and we gave our Twitter names at the end, I'm just like, oh man, this could have ended real poorly. Like, we really did need to get it out when we got it out.
Yeah, no, it's I don't it, all I did was press a couple of buttons. Although I will say it's a pain in the ass to find it, but there's a couple of handy guides out there about how to I forget what the term is, deactivate I believe your Twitter account and you know, if that's where you feel like you need to be you know, I think we've talked before about how I said I was always under the camp that said inactive accounts was actually more important because it showed that there was a bunch of people on Twitter just not doing anything. And that is still, I think that is still how some people are looking at it. But I think more and more with the we've crossed the tipping point now where the number of people leaving Twitter is really the number of people are advertisers. When I say people, advertisers are paying attention to and wanted to be a part of that. That's all.
Cool. All right, so this is weird. I don't know how to end the episode without giving our Twitter names. I guess I'll just say, Will, please bring us home.
Thank you for listening to the Say Report with your host Devin Decker and Sijin Serwik. Please follow the guys on Twitter and Facebook by searching for The Say Report, and you can always subscribe on your podcast channel so this is delivered straight to you and you can enjoy it every week. With apologies to your mother, we'll see you next time.